welcome back to another episode of the Tetracast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I am the host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, I have Josh Torres.
Hello. Hi.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
And Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
We don't have any James Galizio today. He had other obligations. We hope to see him back next week.
Hey, well, I'll go ahead and plug it. He will actually appear on the Axe of the Blood God podcast talking about Trails. Anyways, go check that out if you want, if you're a Trails fan.
But if you want to hear more good podcasting about Trails games, we talked about it last week.
It's true.
First truly played through Dre's break. But yeah, this is the Tetracast. We're recording this the middle of July. It is a very light week in terms of news, but a surprisingly heavy week in terms of releases. We've had, I think, 4 reviews up on the site, along with a few other features from the last week. We got a couple dates and a few tiny little headlines of some ongoing games, but this podcast is going to be mostly focused on games that have released in the middle of July. Some of these, we've had some of our podcast panelists play recently. Some of them they've actually had kind of in the can a while, but the embargo has just lifted alongside the release date. We're going to be talking about these in no real particular order. We honestly just kind of threw darts. But we're going to start off here with a few games that both Adam and Josh have played. And we're going to be starting out with a game that we've talked about on the podcast a few times over the last couple of years as kind of like a game that seemed interesting that we didn't want to let fly under the radar. We'll see if the release has kept up to that optimism. And that is Flintlock, The Siege of Dawn. We're going to talk about this first. Adam, for those that haven't been following this game, like we have, of course, because we do it as part of the site, can you just tee us up? Like, what is Flintlock, The Siege of Dawn? And where does it lie in terms of the releases for this year? Because this has been a pretty stacked year. Where does this game fall? And then, of course, as always, your impressions on it.
Okay, Flintlock, The Siege of Dawn is pretty squarely like a AA game. It's not indie, but it's definitely like lower scope, lower budget. It's priced at $40 on PC, just to kind of give you an idea of like what it's being sold for. So this is a Souls Light RPG from the developers at A44 Games, which is based in New Zealand. And this came out this week. They are the developers behind Ashen, which came out in 2018. I have not played Ashen, so I can't really make like direct comparisons. But, you know, this Flintlock game has shown up in various like stream events, like future game shows, and I think it was even at like one of the Keighley stages once and whatnot. It's shown up a few times over the last few years, and it's like, you know what? We'll try this out. It's something new, something different, something smaller scale, not a big 80-hour AAA release, not a, you know, a big franchise entry, something different, something new. So let's try it. So the premise of this game is that you are playing basically like, or how do I put this? The world of Keon has this gate that basically is in the way of the Great Below, which is kind of like hell, but the developers specifically say it's not quite like hell. It's where the gods reside, and it's where like the dead reside. But this gate breaks 10 years in the past, and the dead, living dead, have been basically flowing out of this gate and, you know, causing mayhem and destruction and death around the world. And you basically play as Nor Vanek, who is a part of a coalition called the Coalition, set to fight these guys. And early on in the game, you meet a feathered fox-like familiar whose name is Enki. And Enki, you learn more about who he is and what he's doing and why he joins you early on. And the two of them basically pair up to figure out what's going on, defeat the dead, and eventually fight the gods of the Great Below. So, like I said, this is a Souls-like game. That was actually something I was sort of curious about, is when you're watching trailers and such for this game, it was sort of hard to tell, like, is this a Souls-like action RPG or just a regular action RPG?
When I watch it, I was getting God of War kind of vibes from him. I don't know why.
I was getting Atlas Fallen vibes.
Yeah.
This game looks like every other game, you know? Just yeah, it's every game at once.
Actually, Atlas Fallen is actually sort of an interesting thing, because when I was playing it, the fact that you have, it's not quite like a talking gauntlet like Atlas Fallen or Forspoken, but it made me think of that. We have like a solo character and sort of like a partner, familiar person.
Their sounding board.
Yeah, you're then a lot of the narrative is literally just the banter between the two. But we actually got a review guide for this game, and literally the first thing they say is, this is paraphrased because I don't have it in front of me, is like, we want to make an accessible entry into a Souls-like game. And I don't think they say, I think they say like a Souls-inspired game. I actually saw some discussion on like, is it a Souls-like or a Souls-lite? And that's just semantics to me. It's got some Souls elements here and there, but not everywhere. You know, whatever, you call it what you want. So you do gain a currency for defeating enemies. It's called reputation in this case. You can either use it to buy stuff like costumes or whatnot, or you can use it to spend on your skill tree. So it's similar to currency in other Souls-ish games. There are no levels. Like, you don't gain levels, or there's no stats that you can put your points into. You just have skill trees that you can put your points into. And there's basically three of them. This is maybe I feel like a lot of games have skill trees these days. But one of them is for your axe weapon. Your main weapon that you do damage with and fight with is like an axe. Your flintlock pistol, titular to the game's name, you sort of like your sidearm. And then also your magic, which is basically what Enki provides in combat. So those are like the three skill trees. And it is sort of a mix between a Souls-ish game and a God of War. So one way in which it's not like Souls is there is no stamina at all. You can, as long as your animation is finished, you can swing your axe again and do your various combos with that. And so what that means is you never really have to wait for... you know, your stamina refill. You don't have to take, like, you know, it doesn't have the same cadence where you usually do a couple of hits and then you kind of hold back a bit to let your stamina refill, do a couple of hits in a Souls game. Here, you can, it's a little bit more upace. You can kind of wail on an enemy more frequently, more rapidly because you don't have to wait for stamina. And so in that way, it is sort of like, it does feel a little bit more like a more typical action RPG, like a God of War or like an Atlas Fallen, because it doesn't have stamina. And I do think Flintlock's most successful component is that it does feel good to play. Just the sound effects, the camera effects, and just the animations when you swing your axe and when you hit enemies, it feels satisfying. Like it feels good to hit enemies and to kill them. I mean, they're already dead, but to kill them again. Most of them are dead.
And that's actually pretty remarkable, because a lot of times with these games that are, like you said, double A, it's kind of like, well, you got to put up with some stiff animations, or you got to put up with some
Euro
jank, whether or not you're saying that endearingly or not. And this time you're like, no, it feels pretty good. Like,
yeah. Yeah. So I think that it feels good to play. And then, so, like I said, it's faster paced battles. Generally speaking, you use your axe to do your most of your damage, and your flintlock pistol can also do a fair bit of damage, but it's most useful for like when an enemy is about to hit you, like when they're about to swing and do their attack. If you pull out your pistol and shoot them, which you can do pretty fast, it can basically stagger them. Not every enemy, but it can stagger a lot of enemies just for a moment mid attack and allow you to get another basically another swing combo in. So that's kind of
the Bloodborne kind of pistol kind of use it. I don't think
I've never actually played Bloodborne, so someone else will have to
Okay, most people use the pistol in Bloodborne to stagger enemies so that you can use a visceral attack on them. That's usually
to kind of boil it down for Adam, it's like basically when an enemy's about to like attack you, you can get sort of use it as a parry. So you shoot them right before their attack hits you, and then they'll like bend down on one knee, and that's like your time where you can like do your like big damage.
Yeah, it's similar. They don't like go into like a hit me now state. It's just more that they stagger for a moment because their attack is interrupted, and then you can swing your axe and hit them again.
Okay,
And so like that's in terms of strategy. That's sort of the strategy is swing your axe when you can, use your pistol when you can to knock them off guard for a moment. There are no bullets in the game, but how it works is, and don't ask me how this works like diegetically in game, but you when you hit people with your axe, your like flintlock pistol charges up to so you can shoot off another shot. So that seems to be the intended design, is you shoot off the shot, and you can shoot off a few shots depending on your pistol that you use, more on that later. And then to reload your pistol, you have to attack with your axe again. So you're switching between the two. Like, you can't just sit back and shoot your pistol all the time because you'll run out and there's no bullets. And then in addition to all of this, Enki can actually kind of attack at the same time as well. So imagine that you're holding back while you're like circling, strafing against the enemy like you would in a lot of these sorts of games. And while you're doing this, you can actually press a button to have Enki kind of like swoop down and hit the enemy. He doesn't really do damage, but he can apply a handful of different types of curses to enemies. And there's a couple of different types of curses that you get throughout the game. One of them is just lowers their armor value. If they have armor, makes them more take more damage from your axe. One of the curses makes them do less damage, kind of weakens them. Or there's like a poison curse and a few others. But also when you attack with Enki, it like fills up a stagger gauge that the enemies have. It's not called that, but it's practically that. And by combining attacks with Enki and yourself, Nor, the other playable character, you can fill up that stagger gauge, and once it fills up, you can then do a critical hit, which of course does a lot of damage, or if they're an armored enemy, knocks off the armor. It can rip off shields and things like that too. So it's sort of this cadence between attacking with your axe, staggering with the pistol, and then holding back at times to have Enki apply curses. And for the most part, it works out pretty well. I do have a few qualms about it. I do think some of the enemy behavior themselves is a little bit robotic, very choreographed or over choreographed maybe, where it kind of feels kind of stiff in terms of how the enemies move at times. And some of the enemy AI is not too bright. You actually do get a flintlock pistol, but like a musket that you can use to snipe enemies from relatively far. And if you have like two enemies standing right next to each other and you snipe one of them in the head, the other one doesn't care. He'll just stand there.
Nice.
Yeah, he's just like, oh, my partner's dead now. Oh well. So there's a couple of things like that where it's like, okay, these guys aren't very smart. They have pretty simple like behaviors and AI that you can kind of get used to and exploit. So there's some of that that's in the game that might feel a little bit more reminiscent of its budget. But overall, I would say that's the strength of the game. There's a couple of subcomponents of the gameplay that are a little bit weirder. So like I said before, there is no level. Like, you don't gain stats through beating enemies, really. What you do gain stats through is upgrading your armor. And actually, I think Atlas Fallen was the same in that regard. Anyways, you can upgrade armor. You can upgrade... you basically get like a helmet. You get a gauntlet thing, I believe. It's more like a shoulder pad. You get your pistol, you get your axe, and you get your musket and grenades. So there's a handful of things that you can upgrade. And there's various... Like, if you find, like, six or seven axes in the game, and they all have slightly different properties. Like, for example, there's an axe that does less damage, but when you hit enemies with them, they can catch on fire, so it does more damage over time. So in some cases, that might be more useful or whatnot. Now, I have a pretty big design component or criticism of this game that I think feels like genuinely bad game design that I'll talk about here. I don't think it's a deal breaker, and I don't think it's that big of an issue due to the length of this game, because it's not a very long game. But hear me out, because I almost feel like this is so weirdly designed that I must be misunderstanding it. So in the game, as you're exploring around the world, I guess I should say it's not open world, even though I've seen some places describe it as open world. It's not really. The game is separated into like two separate zones, and they're kind of like explorable zones. It's actually maybe similar to Shin Megami Tensei V. I have that on my brain because I played that relatively recently. And so as you're exploring through these zones, you can find materials in the world. There's three different types of materials: wood, like iron, and sulfur. And you use these to upgrade your weapons and armor and whatnot. The thing is these materials that you can get, they are finite. Like, they don't respawn. There's no way for them to respawn. Once you pick it up, it's gone. So there's literally only so much you can ever get in the game. Like, once you're out, you're out. And when you're upgrading your axe, for example, you have like seven different axes to choose from. It's six or seven. And there aren't enough materials to upgrade all of them. So you kind of have to pick and choose which one you want to upgrade. And then you kind of have to have like foresight to know, is this axe any good? Should this be the one I upgrade, or should I upgrade the other one? Because you can't upgrade both.
Do weapons upgrade linearly?
Like, yes, they upgrade linearly. Like, so there's no like, there's no like choose this property or that property. It's just like this axe at level one, get it to level two.
So that's very Souls like. Yeah.
I know that
idea predates Souls, but it,
right.
So yeah.
But the thing is like, for example, I got to the end of the game and I had powered up an axe and I was like, I kind of want to try this other axe, but I kind of can't because I use all my materials on the first axe and I don't have enough to spend on the other axe. And it's plus you have to upgrade your armor.
I'm going to ask an obvious question. Just, can you roll back upgrades? No. That's the only thing I could think of. Like, okay.
As far as I can tell, you can't.
Like, that would make any sense.
So to me, that's like a weird design, especially in the game itself. Kind of even suggests like, hey, try different armors and try different weapons. Some will have different use elsewhere, but you kind of can't. You have to like pick and choose what your build is like before you, like, you have to have the foresight to do that. And hopefully you choose one that you end up liking because you can't roll back and there's not enough materials around to like.
So you theoretically have to like just hold off on like using anything until like you're sure for certain what you want to use. Pretty much, and that's the only experimental time.
And
that's weird.
Yeah. So now I do think this is an issue, and I kind of feel like a relatively safe way. I think this could be alleviated is if there was a way to spend the reputation currency on materials, like you could even make them priced at a premium where it's like really expensive to buy iron with reputation or something that you can't just splurge. But I feel like as long as you made it not so finite, you could do that. And you can get as much reputation as you want, because enemies do respawn, and you can just fight them. Now I do think this is an issue, but I don't think it's a big issue because this game is relatively short. And also, I said this when I started talking about this game, it's relatively easy. It's an approachable entry into the genre. It's a short game. I did everything you can in the game, and it was about like 23 hours. I know I've seen people beat it. James, who's played this also, he reviewed it for Games Radar. I think he said he beat it in around 10 hours, and he said he knows someone who beat it in 8. So it's a pretty short game, which that's not a criticism. I'm fine with that, but it is a short game. But it's also a relatively easy game. It has 3 different difficulty modes. I believe it's Story, Normal, and Possessed is the hard mode. I played on Normal, as I normally do for reviews. And it is an easy, if you played Souls-like games, this game will feel easy. It's not a challenging game, but that was kind of the point. And in fact,
that was the intent, right?
Right. I opened up my review with this. When we were introduced to this game by the developer in the review guide, this is the very first thing they said. So this is clearly like the point is this is supposed to be a more approachable game in this space. If you want a challenge, you can try the possessed mode. I tried it briefly and it felt harder, like enemies take more hits, you take more damage. And also there is a story mode, which makes things even easier. And even in the story mode, you can turn on infinite health. Like there's just a built-in cheat for that. So if you are the type of person who mostly plays games just to do the story, you can do that.
How is the story?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, before we get to story, like I know, I kind of accidentally interrupted you earlier, but like, is there anything noteworthy about the bosses or like any like boss encounters in the game?
Because
I know they kind of made a big deal of that before.
Yeah, there are 4 main bosses. They are the gods. You fight 4 gods in the game, and they are pretty good. I wouldn't say they're excellent. They are like, I think besides the final boss, and I think maybe the penultimate boss, I beat them all on my first try, which kind of feels real weird for Souls games because usually it takes a few tries to like get familiar with them. Like, oh, this is how they work and this is their attacks. So actually, because you beat them so relatively quickly, they're almost not as memorable, which is sort of weird. Anyways, so bosses do have unique designs, unique attacks. For example, there's one boss that does sort of they kind of do like a vortex attack that sucks you in. And then if you aren't successful in staying far enough away, they do like this AOE spell around them that does damage. There's bosses that do more physical attacks where they have, large swinging abilities. Oh, I forgot to say, actually there's a key component to the combat. I forgot to mention there is a parry system, like not just your flintlock pistol, but you can parry, you can block. If you block at the right time, you do a parry attack. And these are very, very useful to do. I felt that the parry system works well, and it does have pretty generous parry timing. So if you're the type of person who hears parry and curls up into a ball, you're like, oh, I hate parrying. Don't worry. This game, I think it's true to the approach to the rest of the game. It's trying to make you feel cool, and it's not meant to be super challenging. So parrying
really
is relatively simple.
Like, for me, like when I think of parrying in Dark Souls, I could never get parrying in Dark Souls. I never had the timing. But then parrying in like Wolong, like, oh yeah, it's easy. It doesn't hurt that the enemy's eyes like flash red in that game right when you're supposed to press the button.
Parrying in Lysa P is pretty cool. Anyways, so the parry window is pretty broad, and I felt like parries are very, very useful against some of the bosses. And you kind of learn, I mean, there's certain attacks that are pretty clearly like, oh, here's an attack with a big windup, very obvious what they're going to do. You should probably try to parry it. So I felt the bosses were pretty good. The final boss is what sticks out the most to me, I guess. The final boss is like two phases. It's a big griffin thing. You see him right at the beginning of the game, and it's sort of one of those games where it's like, this is a pretty typical gameplay structure where you fight the boss first thing and you get totally defeated and stomped, and then you come back later like, I'm gonna beat you this time, and you do. So that boss is like a big griffin, does these sorts of beam attacks and whatnot, flops around flying in the sky, charges at you, things like that.
That idea as a concept, where it's just like how straight-laced it is versus like, yeah, this guy that becomes the antagonist within the opening moments of the game, yeah, he's the final boss. Like, we're not going to pull out the rug from under you. We're not going to surprise you. Like, it is what it is. Like,
yeah.
You don't always need to subvert expectations. So I just like that on principle.
Okay, the story itself, I do think, is a weak point of the game. It is, I feel this is going to be a weird explanation, but it does feel like a mix between kind of low exposition Souls style, but also like Forspoken style, your two characters banter with each other, and their discussion does have a lot of the actual gameplay or the game's story in it. So what usually happens is when you're exploring the world, you usually have a relatively basic objective. Like, for example, one of the objectives you have in the first half of the game is we need to get to this cathedral place because they have an army and we need an army to fight the dead. So it's a pretty basic, like, reason to go exploring. Like, we need to go from point A to point B because point B has an army. But what usually happens is when you fight one of the gods, usually during the boss fight, the god will have some dialogue, the gods talk. And I don't want to spoil it, but it's not too surprising that Enki knows more than he lets on. He's sort of like your foil. He knows more about the world than Nor does. So usually what happens is Nor is a stand-in for the player, and Enki ends up kind of explaining, here's who this god is, here's what's going on, here's, you know, why I'm here, and so on and so forth. And I think it was kind of disappointing because that's a lot of what the story is. It's like a god will say something and Nor will be like, what's that about? And Enki will be like, well, it's about this and about that. And then you go on to the next thing and the next god says something else and Enki is like, yeah, there's more to say. There's this, there's that. And so it's kind of very expository in that regard, where just like Enki just sort of tells you the story. And it just,
yeah. I'm kind of grinning right now because I'm still playing through my Elden Ring replay to get to the DLC. And I'm imagining, like, I don't know, Melina or someone being like, so America and Radagon, blah, 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 or whatever. Yeah, it would be much more different game if it was like that.
And then another thing is the story that they try to tell, format aside, I kind of felt like it was a bit contrived just to give Nor enemies to fight. I know this is true for games in a lot of respects, in that there has to be a game there. There has to be like not all games have combat, but a lot of RPGs do, in terms of like you have to have a reason to fight something. But I kind of feel like the reasoning here is sort of flimsy. There were times I'm like, why are we even fighting these gods? Like, this, we could have discussed this, could have just talked, but no, we're fighting. it felt contrived in some way, where it's just like, okay, I guess we're fighting now. So it was whatever, you know, it's not, I wouldn't say it's actively poor. It's just, I didn't care for it. It's just it's not the reason to play. It kind of has
the cards somewhat stacked against it because that's just the norm for like a lot of storytelling in games, modern games these days, and it gets really tiresome when you know seven games tell that present their story in that way. And it's like, oh, it's just like this, you know. It takes out novelty, it takes out uniqueness, it's another run of the mill, you know, storytelling method.
Well, I mean, if they didn't have a physical foil in game, then the character would just like talk to themselves, Tomb Raider reboot style or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I think I've touched on most of what the game is. I gave it a 7. Because I do think it's like, okay, it's an average game. It's a lower priced game. It's not full price. If you just want to try a relatively fun combat system, you know, I actually ended my review saying, hey, this game is on Game Pass. It's kind of a perfect rental game, if rentals still exist, in terms of buy it, you can beat it in a weekend, return it sort of thing, or rent it. And so it's that sort of game where I think it's fine. But the last thing to mention is there are side quests in this game, like literally like marked in a log and whatnot, but they are also pretty plain. It's like defeat some waves of enemies because they're attacking this township, or go over to this section of the map and fight, you know, a couple of enemies here. It's in an optional area, so to speak, but you can do that. There's a couple of different hamlets you can free, which have like they're like little settlements, but they're not really like RPG towns and whatnot. Oh, I almost forgot. I don't know how I almost forgot about this. There's a mini game in this game. I forget what it's called.
Oh no.
It's like checkers. Chow actually saw me playing this, I think, right?
I think I saw you playing the checkers game.
Oh no, it was Josh maybe. Anyways.
Yeah. I was like, it's like Chinese checkers a little.
The weird thing about this minigame is that it feels sort of random because it kind of just depends on what the enemy does, but also you don't get a whole lot for doing it, and there's so much of it in the game. Like, there's just a lot of different NPCs. There's probably like 20 in the game that you can play checkers against, and it's just kind of like, I don't know, it feels kind of weird. There's just like, why are there so many people who play checkers?
Anyways. Oh, there's no like in-game explanation. I mean, it's just a fun thing.
Yeah, it's just a little side thing. It's just sort of weird. Like, there's more than I expected. There's probably too much, honestly. If you were like too many people want to play checkers, but yeah, that's my feelings on the game. Yeah. It's kind of an average game. I wish the story was a little better. I wish some of the item upgrading stuff I kind of felt like is a little bit limiting. Yeah.
Do you think they would make a sequel to it?
Probably the way the game ends story-wise, they could. It leaves some stuff open.
Okay. All right.
Actually, it's
on PC or something like that.
What's that?
Like that? Like performance on PC?
Performed really well for me. I heard that the Game Pass version is actually kind of bad in terms of performance for some reason. I don't know if that's console or PC. But yeah, on my PC,
sometimes the Game Pass PC version, it's been a while since I've played a Game Pass PC game, but sometimes, yeah, they're like a different build of the game. So,
yeah, I specifically saw a headline about stutters in the Game Pass version. I'm like, I don't think I saw stutters. It was pretty smooth for me. I will actually say the game does sort of, it's kind of in between like a hard cliffhanger and just open-ended. It's not a very happy ending. I'll leave it at that.
I'm trying to think of like a spectrum of like in terms of like how the game ends. Is it like on one end of the spectrum is it Forspoken, and then on the other end is like I don't know what it'd be.
Did we ever talk about the Forspoken's DLC ending?
Yes,
it basically is a sequel tease, like more than the main game.
Yeah, it's like a cliffhanger. Yeah.
I completely forgot that Forspoken got DLC.
it's like a 2-hour DLC, also.
I don't think I played that. I completely flushed that out of my brain.
Well, yep. I'll get on it. You have to be Forspoken's strongest warrior now.
Yeah. When they make a sequel, you're going to be totally lost.
Oh no.
Oh no.
I'll never recover.
That's right. Just watch a YouTube video.
I feel bad. We're talking about a completely different game. Here we are taking pot shots at Forspoken.
No, I will be honest. When I was playing Flintlock, I did think of Forspoken a few times. I don't know.
There you go. That's our end point, our bookend. Flintlock is like Forspoken. But anyways, yeah, and being serious though, I do like, it's hard to discuss a game that you do end up thinking is fine. Because you're like, the story was, you know, you don't have something to really latch on to really champion or to really like weed. It's just, it was fine. And that's what your kind of your discussion here reflected and what your score reflected. So it's a fine game. And we end up, of course, I'll shout it out here. You have the written review up on the site, rpgsite.net. If anyone wants to give your thoughts, the written version, a read through up on the site.
Oh, I'm really sorry. There's actually one more thing, one more component of this game that's pretty emblematic to it that I probably should have mentioned. There's a multiplier system with your reputation. Yeah, so like any Souls game, you kill enemies and you get a currency, which is what you use to power up or buy stuff. But in Flintlock, they put a twist on this in that you can get a multiplier to this. It's literally like 1.4, 1.5. And what happens is the reputation that you earn, it's sort of like kept in a pool. You haven't like redeemed it yet, but then you get a multiplier next to it. And then at any time, you can just press a button on your controller to redeem it and apply your multiplier and then receive it. And so optimally, you want to get your multiplier as high as possible before you redeem it. Because then if you have 1,000 reputation and then you have a 1.8 multiplier, which is really high, you actually get 1,800 reputation instead because it multiplies. So how you get this multiplier up is based on basically every sort of different attack that you do adds a little bit to your multiplier. So for example, you get some reputation and you do your normal like full axe normal combo. And you hit your enemy with every attack, that'll add to your multiplier. But if you do the combo again, it will not. So every individual different ability that you do adds to the multiplier a little bit, but only once. Does that make sense? It's not like you can do the axe combo 17 times and have it added to your multiplier 17 times. It's just once. And then if you switch to your other weapon, like a hammer, you can get hammers also. You can do it again, you get even more multiplier. If you attack with your pistol, you get a multiplier. If you do a parry, you get a little bit more. If you do a dodge attack, you get a little bit more. And so basically, the more variety you have in what you do in combat, the higher your multiplier goes. And then once you get that multiplier high enough, it becomes harder and harder to add to it because you've done every variation of every ability you have, right? And then you can redeem it and get that bonus to your reputation, which again is your currency. And so
on paper, that sounds really neat.
Yeah, it is. I think this works pretty well in terms of just, it kind of coerces you to like have a little bit more variety in your approach rather than just like using the same attacks over and over again, even if they're like effective. But the key to this is if you get hit, your multiplier goes back down to 0 or 1. No multiplier. So Basically, it's kind of risk reward where it's like my multiplier is pretty good, but I can get it even higher. But if you get hit, you lose it. So you what you end up doing is you get it fairly high, and you're like, okay, I should probably redeem this before I lose it. You know, here and there. I actually read James's review, and he had a minor criticism on like there are enemies in the world that are like ranged enemies, kind of like snipers. That if you're not careful, it can hit you and you can lose your multiplier. I kind of feel like that's sort of the point, though. I wouldn't call it a criticism on my behalf. Is there are enemies out in the world that if you're not careful, they're just there to just like pot shot you. And so you got to kind of be observant and cautious if you're running around with a high multiplier. There's going to be a few enemies out there that'll just attack you and make it relatively easy to lose if you're not careful. But yeah, I actually felt
that plays. I bet that plays really well if like you were playing the whole game on the possessed mode. That way you can like kind of double up your level ups or whatever you want to call it.
I think it was just an interesting little twist.
Oh.
That's it.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that we play these like AA games for. It's like just to see like, okay, Souls-like is a well-worn, you know, genre. A lot of the ideas have already kind of been explored. But what has not been tried and things like that are things like, yeah, maybe the story is just fine or the gameplay is just, you know, above average. But here's a really neat idea that could be implemented in future games that I hope is carried forward. Another recent release that we're going to go ahead and talk about And this time we're going to put the microphone over to Josh. And that's another game we've talked about several times on the podcast for the last couple of years, and that is Dungeons of Hinterberg. This is a very different style game, but just like for Flintlock, Josh, if you can, for those who haven't been following, just kind of tee us up on what this game is, maybe a point of comparison or two, and then, of course, your final thoughts and your impressions of it.
Sure. So you've seen, like, for people who've you know, been watching Microsoft events, Microsoft has been pushing, you know, this title, you know, during like their indie events and whatnot. Dungeons of Hinterberg is developed by Microbird Games. This is the studio's first title. This is a development studio in Austria that was formed in 2020, and it's published by Curve Games. And the premise is pretty much you take control of this woman named Luisa. And she's going basically on vacation to the Austrian town of Hinterberg. Hinterberg in this game has become sort of an odd tourist trap. Because a few months before the game, where you start a new game, there's been these mysterious dungeons that have started popping up around like the region surrounding Hinterberg. It's a very, you know, enigmatic, magical thing. There's nothing tangible to really explain, like, you know, where these came from or what it is. It's like just a mysterious force that started popping up these dungeons.
Oh, real quick, so, isn't this game set in an Austrian setting from an Austrian developer?
Yeah, exactly. So Hinterberg is set in the Austrian Alps. So a lot of the scenery and the biomes that you witness is based on or inspired by, you know, the real world environments in the Austrian, and you know, and as I mentioned earlier, Microbird Games is a newly formed studio in 2020 that's based out of Austria. So you know, it's basically the developers. I assume most of the developers are local, or if not, you know, has close ties to Austria itself. So it's them working within an environment that they're familiar with, which is smart. And also, like, you know, you don't see much, you know, of the Austrian Alps in video games. So it's a pretty cool title, both in like the just the environment and also just the visual style. Like, the visual style has like a very it's a self-shaded sort of like heavy outlines, almost like comic book style visual direction and whatnot. It looks really, really nice. So basically, like, the flow of the game is that you're going day-to-day in-game, figuring out what you want to do with Luisa's time. The each in-game day is divided into, like three sections. It's like the daytime, you go out into one of the four regions surrounding Hinterberg, and you can explore those maps, trying to find new dungeons. Because there's like 5 to 7 dungeons to each map that you have to discover yourself. It's an overworld like map, but they're not like tremendously huge. The game doesn't like pull any fast ones on you. Unlike, oh, this dungeon like super hidden, you have to go like explore like this super super hard to find path in it. The most it'll ever get do that is like if you have to like rely on one of the NPCs that you can form like a friendship or relationship with, and like one of them, like the dog, might be able to sniff out like a new dungeon or whatnot. But other than that, it's not like crazy hidden or anything in any of these dungeons. It's just going out and like finding the pathways to get there.
How many dungeons are in the game, I guess?
25.
Okay, so there's quite a few.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so yeah, there's quite a bit. And so that's during the daytime, if you don't want to like find a dungeon or go like, you know, you just want to pass the time, you can just go to like these scenic spots within like each region, and then Luisa will be like, you know, I can spend time here, and then spending time here will raise my max HP and my physical defense, for example. So if you just don't want to chill out that day, don't want to do a dungeon, just want to focus on like getting some stat ups, that's totally fine. After you do that, it'll switch on over to evening. Evening, you're back in Hinterberg. You can spend time there either by talking to, spending time with like one of the handful of NPCs with you to either get a chance of like leveling up their relationship, and you'll get goodies out of that, whether that's like max HP up, max MP up. You might even unlock like a new system, like, you know, open it, like, you know, spending time with Thea, for example. She can give you the ability to unlock treasure chests, and so on. Or you could, like, once again, like, save the scenic spots, and during the day you could just spend time during the evening, like, going to like a spa or the cinema in Hinterburg, and then, you know, you might get some stat ups there, and then after that I'll go to nighttime, and then at nighttime you're confined to your room, and you can either just go to sleep right away, or you can like read a book or watch TV, and then you can get stat ups, permanent stat ups from like the social stats of either reading the book or watching the TV. But the penalty is like for the next day you'll get a slight reduction in your max HP because Luisa's tired. But you can keep on doing this. Like, I rarely ever had like full HP because I just either always read a book or watch TV, because the amount of like maximum health it reduces is trivial, I'd say. There's very little incentive to always just like go straight to bed unless you want full HP.
Okay, so this sort of sounds like a Persona-ish calendar, and also social stats.
Sorta.
But I was curious, so is there like a timeline, like you have to do dungeons before a certain point?
So, in terms of
a limited number of days or anything like that?
Not really. There is like murmurs, like, you know, in the game of like the people, these slayers, which are basically people who went on vacation to go beat these dungeons, or like adventurers, who say there's like these 25 dungeons and 25 days challenge. So basically, if you take on that challenge, you basically commit to never doing a scenic spot, you're always every single day fighting a dungeon and completing it that same day, and so forth, so you're never wasting a day in that. But I'm not sure if there's like necessarily a true end that like unlocks if you do this, because I did this and I was like, okay, I saw the ending, but I don't really know if there's like any difference to like what a normal ending would have.
So in your save file, you never did a scenic spot?
I only did it like after at a late game save.
Oh.
For pictures, just to see what it looked like.
Right.
but that's it, pretty much. Just to see what it was. But there's no time sensitive thing, as far as I know, in terms of if you don't do this, you'll get a game over, like in Persona, like a bad end. Pretty much, because there are, from what I can tell, story triggers are activated based upon like how many dungeons you complete. So like, say you get 7 dungeons completed, it might unlock the next part of the overall story that's going for, and so you'll have like some story events that'll happen, but nothing that'll lock you out of like, you know, doing the dungeon that day, pretty much. And even at the near the end of the game, there'll be stuff that happens that feel like it's pushing you and trying to rush you towards like finishing like, you know, your last 2 or 3 dungeons to get to like the end point of the game. But I reloaded like a save that was like at that point, and it is like burned days, like literally like 7 to 10 days after like that event that kind of like pushes you or incentivizes you to go finish the game, but nothing bad ever happened. It's just like I never got like a bad end. There was like an NPC that's like, you should go finish like that last dungeon soon, and then I let like 7 in-game days pass by and nothing ever triggered or occurred. So it's either
doesn't exist, or it's very lenient.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay,
exactly. So I cannot say for sure on that end, because I'm not going to be like 30 and spend 30 in-game days for like an hour and be like, all right, you know, it's like, it's either super lenient or, you know, it doesn't.
Or maybe you're just a god gamer.
Maybe, you know, maybe I'm just too efficient. But in terms of like the game itself, what it excels at, and I was really surprised at this, how well they pulled it off. It's just like just dungeon exploration itself, as the name implies, and if you're just doing like the 25 dungeons 25 days challenge, for example, like you're always, every single day you're finding a new dungeon and you're exploring it all in one go. Sometimes there's like longer dungeons that are waypoints, that have, there's waypoints in them where you can save in them, and then you can always, and then through that waypoint you can teleport out of that dungeon and then just and leave the rest of it for another day. You can do that, you know. I can finish this easy. And the neat thing about this game is that within each of the four regions, there's two magical spells that you pick up through the magic shrine. So once you get to like a new region the first time, there's like this marked place that you should probably go to immediately, because that'll allow you to explore the rest of the region, because you'll need these two magical spells to do mechanics both in dungeons and in the overworld map to reach these dungeons. So for example, like the first region has like, your two magical spells are like summoning this iron ball that you can detonate, and then this ball and chain device is your second magic spell that you receive from the magic shrine. And that allows you to like manipulate mechanics in the environment. Like some areas in the first region have like these jelly platforms that have like a shaped circular hole in them. So like you get out this ball and chain device and like pull that jelly platform towards you. And so that by pulling out that one pathway, there'll be other things in the environment that like may retract or expand other jelly platforms. So you have to sort of go through like either the overworld map or in a dungeon with that knowledge in mind of just basically engaging with that mechanic to proceed forward. And so forth. It's just like that's like a very minor example. Another one is like in another region, one of the magical spells is just summoning like this skate bar snowboard that you can ride. And in some dungeons there'll be like rails that are grayed out, the meaning that you can't grind on them. So you have to do some other stuff in the dungeon to make that rail light up so you can go grind on it and proceed forward.
So I heard that this game was, I've heard this game compared to like Zelda, like old fashioned 3D Zelda dungeons.
Yeah, yeah.
And I these spells that you get kind of feel like, you know, the dungeon items that you get, you know, that in those Zelda games that might interface with the dungeon in certain ways.
Pretty much, yeah. A lot of this game is like using those two magical spells and finding out how to have them interact with the environment. And it gets pretty intricate, like the later dungeons. Like there'll be a dungeon, like, for example, where you have to activate a switch to make a cube pop out, and it's like on this conveyor belt. And at the end of that conveyor belt is like this spiked mechanism that'll crush that cube. So you have to kind of almost race with the cube to make sure that you get to a spot in the dungeon where you can like retrieve that cube before it goes into that spiked mechanism, because you need that cube to press down on like another switch permanently, because you need your other magical spells elsewhere to proceed forward, for example. So it gets pretty intricate, and some of the puzzles are like they're not frustrating. It takes a while to figure out, like, okay, where should I be looking in the environment to proceed forward. It's not like pixel perfect or anything. It's just like sometimes you're just like kind of overthinking it or looking at the wrong place. It doesn't ever really feel like, oh, like this requires so much like precision.
Mentioned in your review that you're happy that you don't have a sidekick telling you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the nice thing about this game is like, there's no, like, Luisa's sword doesn't talk to her. There's no secondary character or companion that talks to you. It's just Luisa and her equipment. And in the dungeons, you're kind of just like left to your own devices of like, hey, okay, I spent like maybe 30 to 45 seconds thinking about this, and I'm still, you know, trying to work my way through this. And there's no like secondary companion or character or talking weapon that's like, oh, you should really try to look at this or go look at this. And it's like, I hate that about a lot of modern games. Like, they don't even give you time to like think about what you're looking at. Like, it's really annoying, actually. Like,
too much hand holding, you would call.
Yeah, it's just like, come on, man. Like, let people think how to, like, solve these things for, like, you know, it really irks me when a game, like, has, like, no faith in its players to just, like, figure out things on their own. There are some accessibility things where, like, in Flintlock, where you never die, for example, like, it won't let you, like, it'll just keep you, like, permanently, like, 1 HP or something. It won't, like, get you, like, a death state. And, like, you know, dying in this game doesn't really... It's not a big deal because the checkpoints are generous enough where, like, you know, you'll just be respawned at, you know, at a nearby place. And then, you know, just try out the combat encounter again. And it's non-linear in the sense that, like in Flintlock, there's no levels in this game. The quality of your equipment determines your levels. So, you have 4 stats: physical attack, magical attack, physical defense, and magical defense. They're all pretty self-explanatory, but there's 2 ratings based on your offense and defense, and your offense and defensive rating are basically taking, like, the sum of your stats, so, like, the sum of your physical and magical attack, and whatever number that it sums up to, it'll give you a rating. So, like, say, you know, you have 300 physical attack and 100 magical attack, that's 400. So that it'll give you, like, a rating of, like, 8, and that's like your kind of level 8 in for your offense. And then say, you know, you have these stats in physical and magical defense, and you might be, like, level 9 in magical defense. And each of the dungeons, before you enter them, are given a rating. So it'll show you, like, hey, are you sufficiently geared for this dungeon? But, you know, but there's nothing that's stopping you. Like, say if you're underleveled, that says, oh, you can't enter. It'll just say, oh, this might be a little bit tougher on you, but you know.
Yeah, it's more like a guideline. Just, you probably should have stats that give you around a ranking of 8 before you do this or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but it's nice. That's like, oh, you're not allowed to do this at all. It's like, no, you can go do it if you want. The only limitation is, like, there'll be some areas early on that are unreachable, and you have to wait for a certain story trigger, for them to become reachable. And the only other. There's only, like, a few special ones, like the ones that I told you about, that dog, like, I was sniffing out a dungeon that's, like that. There'll be, like, 1 or 2 dungeons where there's, like, special prerequisites for that. So, like, that dog is, like, it's kind of a side quest, and it's just, like, hey, go hang out with the dog and then find the dog again in the environment, and it'll sniff out a dungeon. Another one is... you need to take a chopper to go to, like, this, like, far off, like, dungeon, like, on a floating platform, and you need to have, like, a certain amount of, like, renown, which is a social stat, to either to get on that chopper. You can either gain that renown or have, like, one of your NPC companions, like, recommend you to ride that chopper. So if you want to, like, instead of, like, spending time grinding up that renown, just hang out with that character a bunch, and then they'll give you a recommendation that bypasses that renown prerequisite. So there is some flexibility, like, in that instant, you know, on how to reach, like, a dungeon unreachable in that regard, which is, you know, that complexity is nice. It's not like a ton of it, but it's like just enough, just a little. But other than that, like, it's a really, really, like, relaxed game. I would say, like, my biggest issues with it is sort of, like, some of the combat controls feels a little bit sluggish or muddy, like, in how Louisa maneuvers around them. Like, there's the skills of this game are called attack conduits, and there's this attack conduit where she basically spins a lot. And when you have lock on and you use this, like, spin, like, this, like, spinning attack, it could get really, really, really janky in terms of, like, where you're trying to maneuver Louisa, like, because of the way the lock on works. Like, it can get frustrating because sometimes you might be on this, like, boat, and, like, if you fall off this boat in this poison swamp, it's like an instant game over. So, like, if you activate that skill, she might just slingshot too far off into, like, you know, off the boat, and it's like, oh, okay, you have to purposely not use that skill at all or without the lock on to kind of have better control
over where Lovisa is maneuvering in that. So that there is some like weird things about the controls that I don't like in terms of combat, but I do like just the general simplicity of combat of like it's not all about like, you know, parrying or like having like, you know, stick like, you know, QTE timers to do like some cool thing.
Yeah, it's very advanced combo attacks and whatnot.
Exactly. It's very PlayStation 1, PlayStation 2 era of like very simplistic light and heavy attack chains, and there's no stamina meter that regards how much you can attack. It's all about like very deliberate, more slower paced positioning in combat and thinking about your approach on some of these enemies that might have like more tricky attack patterns, like some will like summon tornadoes and others may have like an AoE marker that flashes for like a second before like it summons rocks that underneath that like do a lot of damage if it hits you. But it's not like, oh, like, you know, you have to go parry these all of these attacks. No, you just have to think about like, okay, I need to back off at this instance, and then like when I see that attack, I'll dodge roll, which does have a stamina associated with that, and then, you know, it'll leave itself open for me to like get a few attacks in before I have to back off again. So I do like, you know, there's strength and simplicity in that regard. It's very fundamental in that aspect. And the flow of combat, once you get like all your abilities or resources going, it's pretty nice. You got, I think one of my criticisms in the game was just like it takes a bit for combat to get going, but once it gets going, it's pretty good. So like your three like attack options that you're rotating through, obviously, is like your basic and heavy attack chains, your magic that you get throughout the environment. It's still just the two magical spells, but you can use them in combat as well. And they cost MP in combat, but if you're not in a combat encounter, you can use them freely. And then the attack conduit skills. And there's certain properties to like these attacks that will allow you to rotate them. So for example, if you use a magical spell and you're running low on MP, you can use like your basic or heavy attack to recharge your MP, and your heavy attack recharges your MP more than your basic attack, but you have to commit to longer animations to do more damage, but also to recharge your MP, while your basic attack is faster and generally safer, and your attack conduits work on their own separate cooldowns, but you can equip these things called charms on your character that are basically, you know, little accessory trinkets that alter certain things about your character. It could be flat, like, you know, status, but it could be like, hey, you can now, your attack conduits now recharge your MP, and you can also have charms that are like cooldown reduction on your attack conduit. The charm system is pretty, pretty cool in how this game handles it, because you'd have multiple charms equipped onto your character, but it's dictated by the amount of slots they take up on your character. So you have like 9 slots on Luisa, and there'll be some attack charms that take up 1 slot, 2 slot, 3 slots, 4 slots, etc. But later on, you unlock a system where you can spend mats to reduce the amount of slots a charm takes up. So you can have like this 4 slot charm, you can spend mats on it to only take up 3 slots or 2 slots. Or 1 slot, as long as you continually have enough mats to feed into it, you can just you can bring down the amount of slots it uses up all the way down to 1. So you can have like, you know, like I had multiple like cooldown reduction attack conduit charms on me, all only taking up 1 slot, and then other ones may take up like 1 or 2 slots because they don't have enough materials to bring them down to 1 slots, but it provides like a nice character building aspect and build to Luisa, because now like by the end of the game, my attack conduits are recharging up so fast that I can use them to continually do DPS while charging my MP, and while they're on cooldown, I'm using my magical spells, and if my attack conduits aren't up, I'll do like 1 or 2 like slashes to refill my MP. And then I might have my attack conduits back up, use them, that fills up the rest of my MP, use them on magical spells, and so you have, sort of have like this almost like attack rotation going that you'd see like in like say Diablo or Path of Exile, sort of like you know you become sort of like a machine and sort of like how you gain the resources you need to use offensive abilities, which is, you know, a really satisfying way to kind of play that game.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to approach progression without having like set levels, and it's not even, you know, not quite, it's sort of an equipment based progression, but having like the ability to how you set up your conduits or your charms, or I might get some of the terminology wrong, but
yeah, it's fine.
In terms of
my brain was switching between Paper Mario badges, Hollow Knight pins, and then I believe Ori has something similar.
So it is pretty cool. Like but combat becomes really, really satisfying in that game. And the one other thing that like I didn't like, but I understand why they chose to do this is like the enemy designs aren't that great. There's like over 20 enemy types, and there are definitely some that have like unique behaviors and attack patterns. But just that the design of them is sort of boring, because while there are some that are like, you know, spider-like, or one that's like has like a giraffe, like a long neck like a giraffe, their bodies themselves are always like this black magical goo. And the only thing that distinguishes like them from others is like the design of their masks, you know, which is cool, but the rest of their bodies is like this black magical goo. The only exceptions to this are like the few big region bosses and some of the later dungeons that are like more like boss encounters, and these are few and far in between. But each of them are very, very well designed to make use of the magical spells that are in that region. Like, you have to really fully utilize like each of that the mechanics that you learned on how to use these magical spells for those boss fights, and those boss encounters are really, really awesome in that regard. Like I said earlier, if you have sort of an itch for like neat dungeons and dungeon exploration and like puzzle platforming, just something that's like it feels like it's been de-emphasized a lot in modern RPGs, this game will really scratch that itch of like really satisfying dungeon mechanics and ways it switches up dungeon layout pretty much. Like, some of the dungeons will switch you out to like an isometric perspective or a side scroller. Some of them get really rigor. You're traversing through them unconventionally. Like, you might your character might go be like sideways or upside down in some of them. As you're trying to figure out, you know, like, you know, levers and switches to properly progress through a dungeon and so forth. The story, here we are again, like, you know, in terms of like the overall story, kind of leaving it towards the end.
The story paragraph at the very end.
Yeah. The story is okay. You know, it's not nothing like spectacular, but it's effective pretty much, but it's predictable. Like, there's no voices in this game. They work within their means and allocated their resources to like the strengths of the game, which I admire. But there's no voice acting, and that's totally fine. But the events are, you know, it boils down to, you know, the dangers of commercializing something which is foreign and unknown, and like, you know, the dangers surrounding that. Like, you know, I won't get into any more of it than that, but it does come to like some interesting moral grips of like, hey, you're commercializing this thing, it's making a lot of money for this town, but if you do all these dungeons, all of this will disappear, you know? So like, how will that affect people who have like made a living pretty much like commercializing this sort of tourist mechanism and so forth. Which is interesting enough, but I wouldn't say it's like amazing. It's like yeah, you know, it has some stuff to say, and it's all right, and all the characters that you meet are like, some of them are pretty cool, but it's nothing like revolutionary or mind bending. It's like simple but effective, you know. Like, there's this cool guy that's like, it's like who has sunglasses on and like a big like black trench coat on. And he's like speaks mysteriously and so forth, but he's like kind of like a big dork, which is I love about him. There's another one that's kind of obnoxious, like a German influencer, and he's kind of dressed very flashy and showy, But, you know, but there's like an interesting, you know, arc with him and like, you know, getting to know the person beneath, like, you know, all the influencer garnish that he has to go through and so forth. And there's like the ice cream lady who's just a sweetheart. And of course, the dog, you can just hang out with the dog. He's awesome. You can give the dog its own name. There's like a list of names. It kind of does it like almost like a Eden Chronicle 100 Heroes style. When you're like naming your town, and it gives you a list, and then but the other but there's like an option at the bottom that's like you can have more names. You know, there's other names options, and it's like it kind of does that for the dog, and it's like okay,
what do you name the dog?
Walter, I believe.
That's a good name.
That's a good name.
Yeah, Walter's a good name. And yeah, it's a really enjoyable game. Like as their first game, as their debut project, I was really, really surprised at how well it came together. It was a very pleasant experience. But yeah, it's a game that has like a few flaws, but it sets out. It had like a strong vision of having beautiful environments to express the personality of the Austrian Alps, and having strong dungeon design to accompany that. And you know, they really, really succeeded on that vision of just having a very enjoyable experience all around. I think it is on Xbox Game Pass, like Flintlock. So people who have Xbox Game Pass can check out the game in that way. But it's, you know, it's also sold for less than MSRP. Like it's not a $50 or $60 game. I forgot the exact. Go check it out.
Looks like it's $30.
Yeah,
on sale for a while for 27.
Yeah, and you know that's a well-priced game. I think people should really give it a look if they want that sort of like dungeon exploration experience, like variety in it. It's awesome.
And just like for Flintlock: The Siege of Dawn, Josh should write up a written review for Dungeons of Hinterberg up on the website at rpgsite.net. And keeping with the same theme, we're going to go into another game. This one is more strictly an indie release. I guess Hinterberg is kind of indie, while Flintlock is that double A space. This is a game that we first covered on the website about in 2020. Then it went dormant for a while. I think a lot of eyes were drawn on this specifically for the art style. And this is Gestalt, Steam, and Cinder. And when it showed up, it immediately drew comparisons to Castlevania, specifically Symphony of the Night. Particularly because of the way that the movement animation is very clearly playing homage to Symphony of the Night and Alucard. But the game finally released this year on PC only at this time. While our reviewer for the site is not on this podcast, Junior, he's in the Japanese time zone, so it's middle of the night for him as we record this. Adam has also played Gestalt, Steam, and Cinder. So we'll kind of have two impressions for this game. We'll have Adam's impressions here on the podcast, and then we'll see how those compare or contrast with the written impressions for the website. Because, surprise, individuals don't always have the same opinion, even if they write for the same website. I know it seems obvious, but that's how it goes. So without further ado, Adam, again, same song, third verse at this point. Gestalt, Steam, and Cinder. Not everyone's been following this to the same extent. I kind of teed it up a little bit here. But you can kind of go ahead and talk about your impressions with this game, your opinions on it, and then if you've read the review and edited the review on the website, you can kind of compare and contrast yours versus Junior's, and what you felt about it.
Okay, so I have played a good handful of Metroidvanias, but not a lot. So I'm not like a genre expert that can tell you exactly how this game slots in and what's it more like and what's more unlike or whatever. But anyways, so this game, you know, 2D side scroller, action platformer, Metroidvania, there's definitely components of, you gain upgrades to your moveset and whatnot that allow you to reach things in previous areas to retrack or backtrack and, you know, collect upgrades and stats and whatnot. So I'm going to just start out with, I'm trying to think how I want to discuss this game. This game is pretty short. You can beat it in 6 hours, which I know this genre is relatively shorter games, but this is a shorter game. You can beat it in like 6 hours. Doing everything, like collecting everything, is like 9 or 10. And the part about this game that it's a criticism, really, but I'm starting with it because I feel like it's the most representative portion of the game, is that this game has a lot of dialogue and a lot of story exposition, a lot of text for the length of the game it is. This game is trying to put together a very, like, it's trying to build this world and these characters and this premise, which I'll get to in a second. And I think it kind of has this effect on the game where it almost feels overstuffed with that. Sorry if that's a weird way to start this discussion, but I kind of feel like when you play the game, this is something you'll kind of realize pretty soon. So that's why I wanted to start with it. But anyways, Gestalt Seam and Cinder, it's set in like sort of a steampunk fantasy city. And there's this lore behind the city that I won't truly get into. One, because I don't fully remember it. And two, I just don't feel like it's that important. Where that there's this, you have the residents of this city, and there's this gate in the city that is never supposed to be opened, and you don't know what's behind it. And the city is powered by this sort of magical steam. And then there's outsiders to this city that are basically gearing up to attack it because they want to open the gate. They need to get behind it, but they believe there's power or something, or you don't know what, behind this gate. So there's this sort of faction versus faction thing that's going on here. And there's this government in this city. I believe the city is called Kanan. And you have like this sort of like prime minister and kind of like four, like the elite four, basically. Your character is more like a mercenary. Your name is Alethea. This is sort of a kind of like a Van Helsing type female with long red hair and one of those wide brimmed hats. Pretty cool design, to be honest. Swordswoman. And you are basically like a mercenary. So you're not really affiliated with this Kanan City government. You're kind of just doing what you want to do. And you realize like how your character's role in the story and whatnot as you go through it. But basically, it's the art style of the game is really what, like you said, Brian, draws eyes to it. Pixel art, very good pixel style animation, especially with like Alethea's hair and whatnot and her sword skills and the fire effects that you can get and whatnot. It looks pretty cool to play. Those who like pixel art and that sort of style, you know, visually, in terms of like the visual presentation of this game, it's great. A lot of the enemy designs are pretty cool too. A lot of the environments are really cool. It's got that steampunk kind of industrial, you know, setting, locale to it. Metroidvania style, so side scroller, you gain double jumps, you get an air dash. As you play through the game, you get some combos throughout the game. I was actually looking at some of the earlier screenshots for this game that they released a long time ago, and it looks like they changed things up quite a bit in terms of how like the stats and such work. In this game, there are some stats that you get, but kind of like Flintlock and also like Dungeons of Hinterberg, you don't raise these like intentionally. What I think it seems like it was changed from like the original debut of this game. But instead, there's like almost like a sphere grid, in that there are nodes on a sphere, on a grid, that you can unlock that give you different, that give you like small stat increases, and also different passive abilities and sometimes different active abilities that you can use on this grid. And so you gain points to spend on this grid as you level up. So you don't really get stats, but you get points to spend on a grid. And then you can also find these out in the world, and that's one of the reasons to explore. And there's a handful of collectibles that you can get and whatnot. It actually has a pretty fun collectible that I like. One of the things that you can collect for one of like the game-long side quests in the game are corgis. You get to find corgis and collect them.
But, so like Kingdom Hearts 1, 101 Dalmatians or whatever it is.
Yeah, sort of, I guess. Yeah, yeah, you're just finding corgis, and then you talk to like the leader corgi. You don't talk to him, you just pet him, and then
the leader corgi.
Or, yeah, there's a corgi that's looking for the other
Tales of Arise Hoodles or whatever they're called.
The owls.
I'm sure there's lots of more better.
That's cool collectibles.
The question is, can you pet them?
You can pet them.
Hey, okay, game is saved.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a pretty short game. Like I said, I almost beat it in one sitting. Not quite, almost. And the story itself, I really feel like it needed to be like edited, or the game needed to be longer so it could be like stretched out a bit. Because it, I think even Junior was more positive on the game than I am. I think it's okay. Junior gave it a 9, which is a pretty high score. He said he actually kind of liked the story, but even he criticized, I believe the way he phrased it was, let me look it up here, actually. The story does feel a bit at times like it's too often throwing keywords with a capital K and pushing you along. And I felt that. Like, this game, there's a lot of jargon that it just kind of like shoves in your face very often, very regularly, almost every cutscene. So you got to try to, like keep on top of like, wait, who is what and where am I and who are they? And I overstuffed is the way I would put it. It just feels like there's a lot for the length of the game. And, I wouldn't say it's great. I wouldn't say it's like bad inherently, other than the fact that it just shoves a lot at you very quickly. And so I do feel like that's something that could be off-putting to people in that regard. And when looking at some of the other reviews, it seems like this isn't a unique take of mine. It does have.
I totally get it, man. I'm definitely the kind of guy that's like, okay, if you have a really cool gameplay and experience going, I really don't want to like spend so much time on exposition and the story and the dialogue. Like, there has to be a better way to integrate that within, like, when you're like playing the game, because if you're just like, if you're taking so much time in between like gameplay spurts, especially when the gameplay is compelling for that, it will lose me if you do it a lot.
Isn't that like one of the biggest weakness from like what is it, Sinless Zone Zero? Because it feels like I can't play too much of an action segment. There's too much other shit in between.
I kind of like the Zenless Zone Zero story and interactions. I mean, we're getting kind of off topic, but like that really doesn't apply.
I'm just using it as a comparison. I see a lot of people complaining in like Reddit forums saying that I just want to get to the action part.
Or for me, it's like Wuthering Waves. And Wuthering Waves has like a lot of that shit, and then I just skip the story because they allow for that, and then that's fine. So I guess in Gestalt, is there like a way to just like immediately skip all of this shit?
No, there's not.
Okay, so there's a problem. Yeah, if there's no story skip, then yeah, like that's annoying because you have to go mash through dialogue boxes for God knows how many minutes just to get back to like a compelling gameplay.
Now, yeah, we've talked on this podcast before. This is one of Brian's sayings, or I think it's Brian's saying. We all say it though. Or like, I like games that shut up and let you play. This isn't quite that. I almost feel like it's not necessarily that there's just too much, you know, how do I put this? It's really more like the pacing of things, where there's just like, it almost feels like the story here is fine, and even the dialogue sequences is fine. I just wish there was more gameplay in between them.
Yeah, and a way to integrate, like, I'm sure like what they have is like really cool. There's like building up that world, and like, I'm sure it's really compelling. They have like a lot of, they have probably like a lore master. And the development team, and I'm sure it's really cool, but there has to be a better way to like let players play the game as you're doling that out. Like, so much of that is like through presentation, like are better ways to intersperse that, you know, or convey that in a way that doesn't like feel like it's blocking the player out of like a good time, pretty much, whether it's like making it more succinct or making the explanations like, you know, just like conveyed in a more efficient manner, you know, like
just copy Castlevania, guys. I think the entire story is probably like 4 paragraphs at most, and in my opinion, that game.
Yeah, I mean, Castlevania does a great job of like there's character interactions, and there's definitely a story.
I think the story is great. And you didn't even get like enough backstory from just like this one scene. That's it. It's like there's not much dialogue to it, but I feel like I know enough.
But it's very efficient with the way it's like. There's definitely some Castlevania entries where they kind of yap too much, for sure. Like, I think I know a lot of people like Aria of Sorrow. I like it too, but I think there's a lot of it kind of is not efficient with that in that regard with it. But I do like Aria of Sorrow though.
but all, yeah. Also in addition to the go ahead.
When you said it was 6 to 10 hours and it's bogged down with this dialogue, like I was thinking like Ori is more like a 10-15 hour game, or Hollow Knight is a much longer game. But even then, Hollow Knight is just big. It doesn't have, it's still kind of a muted in terms of like not a ton of exposition. At least my memory doesn't say that there is. Maybe I, you know, it's been a while, but just the fact that it's a 6-hour game, a game that you can almost beat in a single sitting, but yet you still say there's too much dialogue. This really kind of shows how you said it's not necessarily bad. It's just a bad balance of gameplay to story.
And also, not only is there a lot of like jargon in the story, which is kind of just, it's almost just like makes it worse or emphasizes kind of how weird it is. But there's some of like the more villainous characters in the game. They're the type of villain who speak in a lot of vagaries, where they're like, I don't know exactly what you want, because you never say exactly what you want. They just are like, we need to open the door. You don't understand. We need the power of the door to open. And it's just, you would.
They're a trails villain.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah, but like, I know you're drawing the comparisons, but like in Castlevania, most of the bosses are like, okay, I'm gonna beat you up. They don't really say anything. Great. You know? We're here, we're gonna fight. Let's go. I don't need a Castlevania boss to tell me Dracula's that way. You know? It's like, don't give a fuck.
Yeah. I got this game for free because I got an early code. I don't know how much it costs. Let me check real quick. It's a short game. It's the type of game where you could play it, and like I said, almost beat it in a single sitting. So it's $20. So it's a $20 game.
It's a fair price, I would say.
Yeah.
I think I'll be more interested in it if they ever add the option to like do a story skip, because I already know. It feels like everything about this game, I would like play it. I would not like so much to read it that much, and if I'm caught reading the dialogue there for more than like 5 to 7 minutes, I'm not gonna get bored really
like
fast.
I say, I never would skip story scenes in games, but I will criticize it if it's long-winded.
I will meet you halfway and like make it like try my best to like get engaged in it, but if you start losing me, which I feel like it'll start losing me in this game, and you don't have a story skip, I'm gonna get really start getting really annoyed then, because I just want to play the game. At the end of the day, I play video games to play them. I don't play video games to like read them, you know, unless it's a genre like a visual novel, then yes, you know what you're signing up for. You're not going to a visual novel to like skip the story. You're there to read it, but a visual novel has to be smart about it too. Like, for example, there's multiple routes. There has to be an easy way to skip all the dialogue that you've already read and recognize that there's a new piece of dialogue that you haven't read. It'll stop right there, you know. Like I talked about it last week, but Muramasa, they do a really, really nice job of like presenting you of like what you've already read and what you haven't read yet based on like the color of the text. If it's like a more grayed out text, it'll show that you already read it. If it's like more of a like a white text, it'll show that that's new dialogue. And there's two different types of skip in that game, where there's a skip button where like it'll go through a lightning fast speed of through all the text that you've already read and stop immediately when there's like new text, and there's a fast skip option where it'll just like immediately just like warp you to the next piece of text. So like there might be like a whole chapter that I've already read that there's no dialogue options for, so there's no variance in it, then I'll just like say I'll just use fast skip, and then it'll take like maybe 3 to 5 seconds to get to like to a new part where, you know, of text that I haven't already read already. So there's definitely ways to like be efficient in even in that genre of not wasting your time too.
Anyways, the action combat in Gestalt I thought was pretty good. There were a bunch of different combos that I unlocked that I never really used because I felt like I didn't need to. The game is not that hard. To be honest, I don't remember if there are even difficulty modes. I just played it and forgot. But you gain some different abilities as you play through the game. You, like, for example, you gain one of your, in terms of like meters, you have your health meter, of course, but then you gain like these sort of charges that you get that you use to fire your gun, or they can be used for like a flame attack with your sword. So you start out with only one, so you basically build up your charge of one, and then you can use either a bullet or a flame attack. But as you progress through the game, I think you can get up to 4. And so you're, in terms of like the combat, that's sort of the cadence, is you do some regular attacks, you build up this charge, and then you can do like a gun attack, which has its own properties, or a flame attack. Some of the enemies have like a shield that you have to take out with, you know, or you do more damage if you can take it out with your gun and whatnot. So there's some, you know, strategy there in terms of what types of damage you're doing. I think it's all good, maybe not great, but good. Kind of like with Flintlock and also Dungeons of Pinterberg. You're playing the game mostly for the game itself, and it's unfortunate that the story stuff, I feel like, does get in the way a little bit. But I would say this game is okay. Kind of like Flintlock.
You're reminding me, like, even in Dungeons of Pinterberg, you even have, like, a fast-forward option. Like, even if you don't care about the text, like, you know, the text is fine, you know, the conversations are nice. Like, I rarely use the fast-forward option, but there's just a way to, like, kind of, like, even though there's no flat-out skip, there's a way to just, like, just bolt through text if you don't want to read it, and you just want to, like, get to the option that you want, and then move on. It's like, they'll even, like, give you a concession there, like, okay, if you don't want to... If you don't really care about the story, that's totally fine. As long as you know you're playing the game and enjoying it the way that you want to, and that's totally cool. Like, I know that people will. I know a lot of our listeners might like hate to hear this, but there are definitely, you know, some people who play FF14 that skip the cutscenes. They just want to play the game. You know.
Yeah, there are that player base. There is one that rush through the end, beat all the latest boss, skip all the story, then they go back and replay the story later because they want to get to the gameplay content first.
Yeah. You know?
I don't hate them for it. It's like, it's a fair move.
Some of you, I respect that, you know? Do you want to play it, the game that your own way? Go for it, you know?
I don't really have anything else to say. Yeah, I was just going to say, she had another review that went up in the last 7 days. We have it up on the website, rpgsite.net. And we do have one more game to talk about that we also have a review written up. James is the person that we would have handed the microphone off to. This is a game that I feel like has become kind of like very good word of mouth over the last couple months. And that is through different preview events and a little bit we've talked about it here on this podcast. And that is from Capcom, Kunitsugami Path of the Goddess. Now, this is the game that I probably have been following the least out of the four that have been listed. I know James has played it and wrote up the review. Reminder, I think, Josh, you played it at a preview event at PAX?
No, I never played this.
Like, I played this at Summer Game Fest.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay, yeah. I misremembered who had played it.
Yeah.
So,
I did spend like a little bit over an hour with the full game and kind of have a grasp on like the what it's going for, general, like, flow and mechanics and so forth. This is a really interesting, like, experimental game from Capcom. I respect Capcom because it's still one of the few big companies out there in the modern age that's like willing to like just have experimental titles. You know, like titles like Exo Primal may not have like had like the legs that like people wanted to, but it's a very interesting like kind of game that they released last year. That like kind of like defied expectations and so forth. It did find its player base before it eventually petered out, and you know, so forth. But Kunitsugami Path of the Goddess once again is another experimental title that it's very, very difficult to like say what kind of game this is because it's so doing its own thing, and so the general setup for this game is you're playing this character named So, S-O-H, who's been tasked with like protecting like this shrine maiden, and the whole goal of this game is to eradicate this evil force called the Seeth, S-E-E-T-H-E, Seeth, and they only show up at night, and this game is divided up into stages, and within each stage, you control So, and you have to kind of carve a path for this god, for this goddess, the shrine maiden, sorry, to get to like a Torii gate. So what you need to do within each stage is, it's kind of, this is gonna be very, very hard to describe verbally. Within each stage, it starts out at daytime, and in real time, gradually shift to nighttime. And during nighttime is when the Seeth appear. So during the daytime, you have to maneuver So to carve out a path for the Shrine Maiden to the Torii Gate, and the Shrine Maiden will very gradually kind of dance her way towards the path that you've carved. And as she's making her way towards there, you go around with So to take out like sort of like this defilement, clean up these areas where it's been defiled by like the Seath, pretty much. So there's like no enemies that you fight yet, but you do have to go do some cleanup. And as you're doing this cleanup of like taking out this defilement, you'll gain these resources, these crystals, for when you free villagers from this defilement as well. You can hand them roles, so you can give them like a job class. So at the beginning of the game, like only this woodcutter class like is available, where like you can give them like the warriors or assign like the warrior class through like the woodcutters, and so forth. And once you and doing this costs crystals, pretty much. Sorry, I'm losing my mind.
I played this, so it was making sense to me. There's like a crystal currency that you get that costs, that almost everything costs this, like in terms of upgrading people and other things you can spend it on. And you gain crystals. I'm trying to remember exactly how you gain the crystals from my demo time. You gain them more as you complete levels and defeat enemies.
Yeah. The way that you're describing this game, I don't know. I in my mind, I feel like I'm hearing Fort Condo made into a full video game. I don't know.
There are some tower defense elements to it for sure. And like you are placing villagers in certain spots of the map, and there's certain types of villagers that do different things.
Yeah. So this is a third person action game, but you're also repositioning and like these villagers that you free, that you've assigned job classes to. So when it's time for the Seath to come out and you fight them during nighttime in these stages, your villagers will fight on their own based on where you position them, though you can always reposition them as well. So like eventually you'll like unlock like an archer class. You might want to position them like further out from the Seath, and then like the warrior classes more closer to the Seath. So you have like this whole system like where one archer and three warriors fighting them off, and you're fighting them off like alongside them during this this nighttime. So you have to basically wait until nighttime passes for like to continue making progress for the Shrine Maiden to get to the Torii Gate, and then once you get to the Torii Gate, you open up the next part of the stage, or that could be like the end of the stage, but sometimes there'll be stages where you open up one Torii Gate, and then the next half of the stage opens up, and you have to kind of do the same thing again, where you carve a path for the Shrine Maiden to get to that Torii Gate, while cleaning up defilement along the way. And then like once you clean up all the defilement, there'll be like certain like shrines that may open up, and that'll give you equipable like upgrades for in between stages that you can equip them. So like these upgrades might be like, oh, increases the max health for villagers, or it makes it so is less noticed by enemies, so you can have a better initiative on them while the aggro is focused on your villagers, and so forth. And then you also get like healing items throughout the stages that you can both heal So with, or you can use those healing items for like individual villagers who get low on health, and so forth. So it is a little bit of tower defense. I hesitate to call that, because it's not really tower defense. Because like you can just basically park your villagers up by like a spawn gate, and like have them be more on the you can push the aggression towards that initial bottleneck. But I'm sure as stages get more complex, you have to be more mindful of where you position them, and then you have to start thinking about like enemy routes through multiple angles and defending like multiple positions with your villagers and so forth there. And that I think that like that gameplay mechanic, it's not going to be for everyone, but I think it's really cool the way they've done that, especially because in between stages you establish bases, and you can like use like a currency to upgrade like individual roles and classes. Like I can use resources to upgrade the warrior class, that they'll get more health, more attack, but they'll also like eventually gain the ability to like pursue like fleeing enemies on their own, and so forth.
And also, I think it is worth noting, you can replay stages.
You can replay stages.
So there's, you can grind to some extent in terms of, like, I want to get more upgrades. You can. And you get, there's like a scoring system also. I forget exactly how it works, but, you know, if you do a stage well enough, you can get scored for it.
And also you can roll back upgrades too on your, like, the classes as well. So, like, if you are not satisfied with the way that, like, a class is performing, or you want to invest more resources to pumping up, like, this one class and go all in on that and make them as powerful as possible, you can just, like, just stay, you know, roll back upgrades and, like, redistribute those resources for, like, another class you're specializing in, and so forth. And these bases that you establish on the completed stages, you can, there's like a, like almost like a base building system as well, like a very light one where you can allocate some villagers to go restore some part of the stage, like maybe like a structure, and then you'll be rewarded with like you know, some currency that you can use to upgrade those classes, and so forth. And there's also like equipable items that you gain on throughout the stages that you can equip, like raise your soul's maximum health, and so forth. So it's not really an RPG, like RPG mechanics, but there's like RPG light elements to it that RPG players can latch onto. I think one of James's biggest criticisms is, like, while these systems are like work really well in stages because they're designed almost like that tower defense esque, some bosses are don't really work out as well, and they don't really mesh well with these mechanics. I haven't encountered these bosses yet, but apparently, like, you know, these bosses would be better suited in a more like dedicated game that's like a character action game. But in this game, like, the character action elements are pretty light. Like, the amount of, like, actions that's available to So himself is, like, it's very limited, right? It's, like, kind of almost Dynasty Warriors-esque, where you have, like, these light and heavy strings, and you have different finishers depending on when you use, like, the dance attack or, like, the heavy attack during the light attack string. So, sort of like Dynasty Warriors. And that's kind of... And he can also equip, like, abilities that can expend the resource to kind of drain, like, a gauge. It's sort of like a more powerful ability. But I don't know if, like, he gets any more abilities outside of that. But apparently, like, you know, there are some bosses that, like, don't really demand more finesse or more, like... It would be more interesting if this was a character action game, because you would have So doing more actions or have more actions available to him, and that's just not the kind of game that Kenitsugami is. And I believe James, like, was able to complete the game, like, in under 20 hours. So it's not like a big game or anything. But I think it's a really, really interesting experimental title that's, like, it's hard to really compare it to, like, any other sort of game. Like, the closest comparison I would give it to is, like, Chaos Legion on the PS2. That was also published. I don't know if it's developed, but it was definitely, there was Capcom involvement, and I think it was.
But yeah, at Summer Games Fest, we said this a couple weeks ago in our podcast about it, but this was the game that basically got the most, like, at Summer Game Fest, it was the game that was like, hey, have you played Kenitsugami yet? That game is cool and different and weird and cool. It was one of those games I think a lot of people got demos for, but maybe a lot of people didn't really know what it was until they played it. And then after they played it, they're like, hey, have you played it? Because it was just so unique. So I think that caught a lot of people in at least our space, you know, in a positive way when they finally got their hands on it. So.
Yeah. I think it seems promising. I think I'm going to come to really enjoy it, but I need to spend more time with it. But from what I've played so far, it's really, really enjoyable. I just love that Capcom, you know, continues to push for these, like, smaller scope titles that, like, while everyone else is, like, you know, doubling, tripling down on, like, their established IPs to do them for, which is, you know, Capcom does do it, but they also find time to allocate resources and staff to, like, these smaller scope titles like Exo Primal and Kenitsugami, just, like, brand new IPs, brand new things that are, like, not from, like, an established franchise and are trying to, like, do their own thing gameplay wise. They're not, like, trying to, like, lean on other established gameplay formulas.
I don't know what you're talking about. Square Enix released a new IP this year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Foamstar.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking like Ubisoft of 12, 13 years ago or whenever, like Valiant Hearts, Child of Light. And like they're kind of getting back there, but it's still like it's Prince of Persia, so it's still a smaller scope title, but it's not a new IP. So hopefully, you know, these smaller not everything has to be Monster Hunter 6 in terms of scope or Assassin's Creed.
It was also difficult for me to get my thoughts in order because as we're doing this, I'm also kind of have watching Evo on the side, and like SNK just announced that that they re-released SNK versus Capcom SVC Chaos on Steam with rollback out now, and it's also coming to consoles, PS4, PS4 and Switch on July 22nd. And they also announced Kevin from Mark of the Wolves coming back with City of the Wolves, and Kevin is a very notorious character. So I was like,
top tier guys, top tier.
It was like I was also just like mentally losing my mind while I was trying to describe Kanetsugami as well. I'm like, this is like an impossible thing to do.
I mean, I'm doing the same thing. I'm watching Evo as well, but I was watching the Third Strike stream, so I had none of the news.
Yeah, so yeah, there's your fighting game update. Ciao, Kevin's back in City of the. He's gonna be a menace once more. So yeah, sorry if that just felt scatterbrained. I was like trying to multitask.
Breaking news at the time of recording.
Breaking news.
Yeah, I'm like trying not like squeal.
Okay, but you know there is technically RPG side in the SNK side of things. There's the Samurai Showdown action RPG that's announced, wasn't it?
No, yeah, they've announced it before, but they reiterated it, and a lot of news outlets reported it as like, oh, there's a new announcement. It's like, no, they've mentioned this before, but you know, maybe this is like the first like outlet that like they've mentioned it to like a lot of people, but they've mentioned before that they were working on a new Art of Fighting and a Samurai Showdown action RPG. Those aren't necessarily new news pieces, but a lot of outlets, you know, took it as that. Whatever, you know. For me, it's just like I have my ear closer to the ground than like most news people, and that's okay.
No, it happens.
Yeah.
There's been a few times when like we get a press release on like a game. Or I don't know, this is what came to mind, like Stellar Blade. It was announced at like, I don't know, some state of play last year, like here's Stellar Blade. And it's like, no, actually this was announced years ago under a different title. I forget what the title was at the time.
Project Eve.
Yeah. You know, it's like we are in that realm where we pay attention to that, but some people they don't see it until it's shown on like a PlayStation event, like an English one, and then oh, here's this new game. It's like, well, it's not really, it was shown before.
Yeah, we're just brain broken because when we hear that like something is new and it's like it's not, our immediate reactions like, well, actually that's not new, and that doesn't really matter at the end if it's new or not,
right? Exactly. And I think like actually I saw there were a couple of previews that went out recently for a game called AI Limit. But that was also one of those games that's Chinese. It's like a Souls like. I guess I was reading some of the previews. I guess it's Souls-like, which is sort of unexpected because it's otherwise more obviously inspired by Nier Automata, which is not a Souls-like.
Yeah, it kind of has like a mix of like Code Vein and Nier Automata-esque things.
But like that was another one of those games where it was sort of re-announced, but it was actually originally announced a while ago. Again, it doesn't really matter, but it's just like sometimes it looks new, but it's not actually like new. It was floating around, whatever.
And then the other one is like when a kickstarted game or a self-published game gets a new publisher, and they're like announcing this that was kickstarted 3 years ago. It's like, oh, okay, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Or that reminds me, it's not quite the same thing, but the trailer for like Greedfall 2. It's like the release date announcement. It's like, well, that's just early access, but it's the headline that gets you to the top of YouTube and whatever Google Discover, is that you just say announcing this. We don't, you know, regardless of whether it showed up at China Joy or had a Kickstarter or whatever.
Yeah, I just think like, you know, but just like kind of getting back to Kanetsugami, I just really respect Capcom for like doing this sort of project, and also just like the way that they promoted it. Like it's very intertwined with like Japanese mythology and like sort of a lot of like the Japanese legends surrounding like, you know, shrines, shrine maidens, and like the like homo evil forces surrounding that. So you have a lot of like traditional dances and the, like real life traditional dances in the promo material for it, which is like, that's really cool to see, you know, how the way they've shown off this game. And once again, it's not going to be for everyone. It's a definitely definitely sort of a game that will cater to a certain niche audience, but I think it's really, really cool what it's trying to do.
And we might hear an abbreviated form of James's thoughts when he's on the podcast, hopefully next week. But we do also have his review up on the website at rpgsite.net. So it's four reviews up in the last 7 days. So two by Adam, one by Josh, and one by James. Or sorry, not two by Adam, one by Junior and one by Adam. Adam just spoke to his behalf here in the podcast. Yeah. My bad. And with all those games discussions out of the way, we'll go into the news section. This is pretty much going to also be the wrap-up because there's not a lot here, but considering the insanity of all the June stuff and early July, I'm okay with a slow week in terms of news. We do have one game announcement here. This is from Hata Studio. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. It's the same studio that is behind Tower of Fantasy. They've announced an open-world RPG called, it's a little bit of a mouthful, Neverness to Everness.
NPE,
what do you mean by that? NTE.
Yeah, so it's just for certain people that sees NTE, their minds go drift out to another abbreviation that's more nefarious and not great. Those are the brain broken people.
Okay, are we talking about NTR?
Yes.
E and R are different letters, so
yeah, I know. That's
exactly just one letter apart if you typed it.
But but that's not the first time I've heard it from Chow, you know. I've heard it from other friends. Like, I just think of NTR when I see it. I'm like, you're so brain broken, man. I don't know what to say. We're not going to elaborate any further. If you know, you know. And if you don't search it up. Do not.
Anyway, we have an announcement, like, reveal trailer for this, which looks kind of like Hoyoverse Zone Zero-ish. But, of course, like, that it's kind of like how Tower of Fantasy kind of compares as a different take on the, like, I compare that to like Fantasy Star in my head. I don't know if that's the best point of comparison, but when I see this, it looks to me like a Hoyoverse trailer. And then alongside that, we also have like a gameplay trailer that's like 13 minutes long and more actual with
a
game.
At least a portion of this game looks like Gacha GTA.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It's like, I already thought it looks better than Sinless Zone Zero. That's my opinion. But everyone's like, it's made by the Tower of Fantasy devs. I can't trust these guys in my life.
Tower of Fantasy has gone through like sort of like an interesting argument. I think it's trending downwards. Like, the last I heard about Tower of Fantasy is like they wanted to like have a new like progression in the way that, like, you know, like people found it very grindy in the way that, like, it felt very, like a lot of its like in-game rewards felt like it just wasn't enough. So they wanted to revamp like the pace of its gameplay so like people felt more rewarded and like so they would level up faster. But since it's an MMO where you shared like, you know, a space with players, they would feel it would be unfair to people who were like Goover, put in all the time and effort and resources to get to where they are. So they wanted to like open new servers that would have this accelerated pace almost. And it just looked like a shit show from the outside, pretty much. So I don't know how that panned out, and I don't know how Tower of Fantasy is panning out now.
I heard it's still doing well in China, but everywhere else is kind of dead for that game.
But the last thing I heard is like it had like an Evangelion collab. With Neverness to Everness, oh my god, the fucking name's gonna kill me. I'm just gonna call it NTE, and hopefully all the brain-rotten people will forgive me for that. It feels promising, but there are certain elements of it that like look new but have been in Tower of Fantasy before, like the customizing cars, for example. I think that the like cars eventually came to Tower of Fantasy, and like a certain degree of customization like for those cars were in Tower of Fantasy, and like that philosophy or like those systems are coming to NTE in some way, shape, or form. There's like definitely a focus on, like, you know, buying sports cars in NTE and like maybe racing them and like going, like, you're traversing through this open world, this city, and it looks very, very populated and very urban.
I first saw this trailer, I think it was like the day before the English announcement. It showed up on what is it, Bilibili, which is like,
mm-hmm.
was it Chinese, like Chinese YouTube,
basically?
Yeah, Chinese
YouTube or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I don't know. It was one of those trailers where you have like the comment text that floats across the screen, You see that
like Nico Japanese... Nico TV, basically.
Yeah, and like, it was actually kind of funny. As soon as the character got into a car, you see a bunch of, because it's all like, I forget if it was Japanese or Chinese letters, I forget. But then as soon as the character jumps into the car, like all the text across the screen is GTA, GTA, GTA.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I got the same impression. I never played GTA Online. Can anyone tell me like what's the GTA?
I don't know about online, but it is worth mentioning. Josh said this, but it does seem to be a pretty significant portion of this game. Like it's even in like the press release, there's even a paragraph that says, besides the main storyline, an in-depth urban life also offers players much to see, like buying sports cars, modifying cars in the ways they like, and racing through the city, which is Hetero's rainy nights, or buying a house and designing it freely, so you can buy a house.
Yeah, there's like business management in this game too, and like, and also housing as well. But in terms of like, you know, just the general gameplay of like outside of those, it resembles a lot of like Genshin or Wuthering Waves. You know, you have like that four character action RPG party where you switch between them in combat to trigger certain like elements and so forth. So there's, safe to say, since this is going to be free to play, there's probably going to be a gacha system in it, probably for characters and weapons. Like those other games, I don't know if there'll be any other gacha systems beyond those, but it's safe to say that the monetization is probably shaping up to be that, because Tower of Fantasy had that same monetization where you rolled for characters in that game. Now, we don't know if it's going to be like an MMO like Tower of Fantasy, that's yet to be determined. This is built on Unreal Engine 5, and it's also coming to mobile, so it's announced for PC and mobile devices, and then for the consoles, at least we know it's coming to PlayStation 5, like shortly, like, you know, a day after this came out, Sony put up on their PlayStation blog that it's coming to PlayStation 5. We don't know if it's coming to any other consoles, but I think like the tech behind it for Unreal Engine 5 is gonna, if it's able to maintain this level of quality on mobile devices, that's like unreal. Like, there's so much detail in its environments and its like exploration based on the gameplay trailer, but like, seeing this run on a mobile device, especially when you're in a car exploring around town with this level of detail, it's like, I feel like this will make my phone explode if it tried to run it.
You try playing?
But by the way, I really had to check this. I'm sorry. Yeah. You said something like the game environments are unreal or whatever. It's literally on Unreal 5.
Yeah, Unreal 5. I think I mentioned it. Yeah, but it's still like.
Check.
Yeah, I know. I didn't mean for that to come out that way, but it that's the word that I thought of that time. And yeah, I've had Wuthering Waves run on my phone. It's okay. I mean, it tweets on my phone and it wants to die, but it works relatively fine. But Wuthering Waves has that open field, sort of empty environment, more barren. While in Neverness to Everness, it's very populated with like tall buildings, city environment. There's a lot of cars and actions going on. It feels popular. There's a lot of NPCs on the screen, like, especially compared to like Genshin and Wuthering Waves. Like, you know, this is the landscape of this game is fundamentally different, and like, especially when you have, there's like certain parts of the gameplay trailer where you have NPCs reacting, like getting out of the way of the car, you know, and that's just like, that's just something you don't see in other games of this nature. The closest that you got was that Project Mugen from that other studio, I forgot who, but that Project Mugen thing is also set in that city environment, but it doesn't really focus on cars. Like, there's a vehicle in it, but in that game, like, the big thing that people latched onto was like the Spider-Man swinging to travel around in that. We have yet to get like another gameplay update on that since like its premiere last year. In this game, at the end of their trailer, is like the next update for it is going to be September. We don't know in what shape or form, but it is leading towards that. I'm crossing my fingers. It's probably not going to happen. But like, I was like thinking like, what's an event in September? And I think of PAX West. And I'm going to PAX West. I'm like, if it's going to be there at PAX West, you know, they haven't said if it is, but if it's going to be there, like, I would love to check it out and talk like, you know, the development studio behind this game. I think it's a really fascinating thing. There's also parts of the trailer where they're like, yeah, where you purchase like an apartment. It's like a very like the apartment's like on the seventh floor, so you actually go into a building, get into an elevator, and it's all seamlessly, like there's no loading at all that you see in this gameplay introduction. It's like you just kinda get in there, write up this trailer, there's no loading screens, and then you exit out into like this very, very fancy apartment, and then after you like kind of they kind of roam around this apartment, there's a certain point where they switch to a character and they sort of do like a gravity rush where they kind of like latch onto a wall, and then they're just like walking on this wall, and then so the whole camera is like sideways, and then they jump off the wall, and then like the camera reorients to like a normal, like, you know, where the gravity where gravity is positioned, and then they kind of go onto like this pigeon or this device or whatever, sort of like, you know, like in Genshin and Wuthering Waves, where you kind of use a glider device to kind of hop off this building back onto the ground level, back to where like kind of they crashed their car. So this their car hasn't been repositioned at all. It's still back to where it is. And then they, you know, they ride off into like another part of it with no loading screen at all. So there's like no, you know, this all in real time, seamless. And to me, that's like absurd, you know, that's like crazy on a tech level. It's very, very impressive. And I'm like, how the fuck will phones run that, you know? I don't know. So to me, it's very impressive on a technical level. And I think there's a certain level of promise that it brings a lot of potential to it. And like, you know, like the very vibrant with its character designs and very colorful. And like, it's just, it looks so cool. And like, it to me, it's just, it's, I have to be very, very cautious about it because like, you know, the way they're going to monetize it, and the developer's track record, like it's just, there's a lot of like very promising and cool things about it, but you know, there's a lot of caveats about it as well. So I'll be on the lookout for it, and just gonna pay attention to see what they have to show, you know, in the coming months as they, you know, continue to show off more of it and see what people are actually signing up for with this game. So I think it's really cool, but. We'll wait and see, and you know, how everything actually works underneath, like, you know, this impressive premiere.
This next update that we have, I think my favorite take on it is actually on Adam's Twitter account, which is more about how the update was delivered rather than the actual content of it. One of the big releases for next month is, of course, the new Mana game, Visions of Mana, from Square Enix, releasing near the end of August. And so Square Enix released a new newsletter on their website that they tweeted out on their Twitter account. And that was kind of it. Like, it wasn't really shared. It didn't have a trailer. It didn't have any other thing other than like a single link leading to a webpage, which feels like very old school, but also like an easy thing that you could miss.
Yeah. Okay. I guess, should I jump in here? Okay. So Visions of Mana comes out in about a month. This update itself, so last month we got the trailer that showed the release date of August. I believe that was last month, right? June 12th. So yeah. And this update is basically introducing one of the NPCs. This NPC showed up, I think, on the website already, but now they're sort of introducing him. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name. It's like Esh. And he is a scholar. He's like a side character. He's not like a party member. Who shows up, a supporting character of some sort. That's all I really know about him, is that he's a scholar. And then we're introduced to three more of the vessels. And to remind you, the vessels in this game, they are basically the mana spirits that have showed up in a bunch of mana games. How they work in this game is you can like get this vessel, like an item, and once you have that, you can kind of apply that to any of the five player characters and they get a new class. So there's eight spirits in Mana games, there's eight vessels, so each character has like eight different variations of them. This should sound familiar if you played Mana games. It's not like any other Mana game, but it's similar. So they introduced Gnome, which obviously is an earth vessel, and you know, similar to other earth type elements, you know, more physical rocks. You can create clay golems, I guess, and whatnot. There's Lumina, light version, or the light vessel, and then there's Shade, who's the dark vessel, and it shows like some of the characters in their different outfits. For example, Gnome Val will be weapon master, Jule, who's a little sprite boy, becomes hunter, while Morlaye becomes ninja master, Lumina Val becomes paladin, Morlaye becomes sovereign, and Palamina, who's the princess queen girl, becomes archmage, and so on. And then we're also introduced to a couple of the explorable items you can pick up, like elementite and gold clovers, which are used to like power up. I won't get into the details here. And also Little Cactus is back. I believe in Japan he's called Cactus-kun. He's a cactus. You find him. He does stuff. he's like a mascot. Anyways, my sort of take on this was people like to talk about like Square Enix is bad marketing. They just need better marketing, right? And I think this update here is kind of emblematic of what I think a problem is. And they've actually been doing this for a while. This is not new. This is a game coming out in a month. And Square Enix's like update for it, there was no press release. And I know to a lot of people that may not mean much, but to anyone who works in media, or even if you're an influencer, you get press releases sent to your inbox or other notifications or whatnot that basically give you media and information about games that are coming up. And they're very useful. It's basically direct from the source. Like, hey, here's a new trailer, or here's some new screenshots, and here's some new information. And it's like directly to you. And we use these all the time to post news and updates. A lot of places do. And not just media, but influencers and YouTubers as well. This didn't have one of those, this update. It was just posted to Square Enix's blog, and they tweeted about it, I think, like, once on the Square Enix account, and maybe once or twice on, like, the Mana account, and that's it. And, like, that's the marketing. It's, like, three tweets and a blog post. And I don't know, that feels like a missed opportunity. Like, even just a press release and getting that out there to media and influencers, you're going to have a lot more people covering it and sharing it everywhere. They don't do that.
I don't understand. I mean, Square's still in the middle of a big restructure. I just imagine things are going to be wonky there for a bit, because I imagine like the pipeline of like just how to do anything feels going to be not standardized for a while, depending on the scope of the restructure.
And also, one thing about Square Enix, this is related, is they have all of their different brand accounts for their different like franchises. But, like, they don't have nearly as many followers as, like, the main account does, the Square Enix account, which I think has, like, more than a million. And, like, so, like, Visions of Mana, like, the Mana Twitter account will post updates for it here and there. Let me just see how many followers, like, the Mana series account has. It's going to be, like, a fraction of the Square Enix account. I found the Japanese one. Let's see. Mana Game is a Twitter one. 30,000, which isn't small, but we have more than that on our RPG site.
How long has it been since like we've been trying to figure out like why Square Enix does the way
What I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to offer like something tangible. Yeah. Like you can't just not just saying Square Enix has bad marketing. Here is what something I think is literally an example of it. And like, will they do anything more before the game releases next month? I don't know. Another blog post with three tweets.
Yeah,
that's my point. I'm interested in this game. I think it looks cool, but
it's just really weird because like with Capcom, it's like, okay, we can understand what they're doing and why they do things because they're very efficient. About Sega, same thing. It's like they really amped up like, you know, the way they've marketed their stuff, like oversaturating, but that's the way to go, really.
You mean so like Atlas too?
Yeah,
well, we talked before, Atlas, they do a billion trailers and you know, it's effective if a little bit overstuffed, but
yeah, but Square Enix is like just a complete enigma, depending on like the project to project basis.
It's or like, they just release a trailer that spoils way too much near the end for some.
But even within the same game, like the way they market it to like different platforms, depending on like if it's a staggered release, complete crapshoot. We don't know how the fuck they're gonna do it. You know,
or like Octopath is showing up randomly on the other platforms. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. Like for example, like Octopath. For an Octopath 2 coming to Xbox and PlayStation, like before at Summer Games Fest, you know, like pretty much a shadow drop on like the way they did it. But for Dragon Quest Builders 1 on PC, here's a press release. We're gonna let you know like 2 months in advance that it's coming. It's like, why did they do that for those? I don't know. One's like a shadow drop for like some of the most revered like RPGs in recent times, Dragon Quest Builders 1, really cool game, not as revered as Octopath, but it gets like the pristine press release and like letting everyone know in advance, while the other ones, complete shadow drop.
Okay. I probably just assume that everybody knows them. They would follow them.
I mean, like, it just feels like it feels like a big no-brainer to at least let people weeks in advance know that they're coming to these platforms, so more people are aware. You know, right?
And like, also, like, Visions of Mana, like at Summer Games Fest, I got to play Dragon Quest, and there's a bunch of previews for that. And obviously, Dragon Quest is a bigger brand, but like Visions of Mana, that would have been an opportunity to have media play it and check it out and write stuff on it. So like, this shouldn't be news to anyone, but like the sorts of news coverage and preview coverage that outlets like ours do, we hope it's useful and valuable, that utility there, that we're covering news and previews and such. But in a way, it is also marketing. Like, we understand that when we write a preview for Dragon Quest, which I did, I'm trying to be informative of like, hey, here's what I played, here's what's included, and here's, you know, my opinions on it so far. But it is also marketing. Like, I am doing some marketing on behalf of Square Enix, getting that word out there, like, hey, there's this game coming out. And like, I was sort of surprised that Visions of Mana had like no presence at all at any of the summer events, because it's like, hey, this game comes out later this month or later this summer. You could have showed it off and get people talking about it. Like, people were talking about Kanitsugami. I don't know. You could have, but you didn't. No. I don't know.
Square, man. The eternal enigma known as Square Enix.
Like, Sega showed off. Sega had Metaphor. They had the Sonic game that's coming out. They had the Super Monkey Ball game that came out. And, like, I don't know. Other companies do it. Square Enix, you could.
Look, shortly after the big restructure and everything is like mellowed out, things will start making sense to Square Enix, like in 2 to 3 years' time. Maybe.
I expect there to be a random Romancing Saga update like this month sometime too, and they'll just post it on their blog and leave it there.
How many followers does the Saga Twitter account have?
Probably not very many.
I'll follow for the gacha game. Probably.
I just don't like. Hopefully, the Romance and Saga 2 remake does well. I just don't know how that breaches the mainstream, man. I feel like it's so. It feels like Saga and mainstream feels so impenetrable.
That feels like a two opposing side of a coin or something like that.
I think Saga Frontier or sorry, Romancing Saga 2. If I said Frontier 2, I meant Romancing Saga 2. That game is like the prettiest Saga game, so that I've seen some people interested in it because they like how it looks. But the fact that it's called Romancing Saga 2 Remake, more or less, I do think might be a hurdle to people. They're like, well, I have no idea what this is, and it's number 2, and it's a remake. I don't know. Do I play this? Am I allowed to?
Am I allowed to?
Well, technically, they already remake Romancing Saga 1. I mean, that's
Mistral. Yeah, they remastered it too, and I think that game is excellent, but it's not as pretty. So.
It's just, man, I got really depressed when you said, when you jokingly said, am I allowed to? It's like, people can play any game they fucking want, man. Doesn't matter. Who cares about the number on it? You see people fucking SMT5 and there's their first SMT that... You know,
Final Fantasy 16, guys. I got to play 15 Final Fantasy games before I can start this one, right?
This isn't here or there, but Alex Donaldson, our boss, he actually thinks Final Fantasy numbered games should either drop the number or add a subtitle.
Yeah.
Because, like, other games like Monster Hunter or Elder Scrolls or what have you, they don't go just by numbers anymore.
Just like,
Resident Evil does, though. Biohazard doesn't.
Whatever. Yeah. You can just play any game you want to. Who cares if there's a number by it? You should be free without guilt to just play any game you want. Who cares?
Fire Emblem never used numbers, but who cares what's titled it? Numbers.
Just play the fucking game if it looks cool to you. Who cares? Who cares if you're allowed to?
Chow was discussing.
I feel like Fire Emblem. People were really good on, at least from my perspective, from a Western audience. Like, even though we didn't get Fire Emblem games localized until GBA, which was 7. I feel like around 10, 11, people like, I have no idea like what Fire Emblem Engage, what number Fire Emblem, is that Fire Emblem 17? I don't know.
Well, it's like you get the remakes and like, does this count as a number or no? Like Echoes.
I think that people just stop caring about the numbers by then. They just qualify their names.
Anyways, Chow earlier before this podcast was looking up the collector's edition for Legend of Heroes 12 or Legend of Heroes Trails 12.
Like, it's the most expensive. Like,
is that 12? Did I count it right?
Well, it's like Legend of Heroes 12 Trails 9 or something, or like, because there's
no, I think
because
No, I think Kiseki 12, but there's more. There's like a couple of Legend of Heroes before that.
Like I said, Legend of Heroes 6. Trails of the Sky or something.
Trails of the Sky is Legend of Heroes 6.
Yep.
And then the Crossfell game is 7. That's what some people, that's what the Chinese people call
that, that's what I should do to gatekeep Trails Down. It's like, oh no, you're not allowed to play Trails at all until you played the 5 Legend of Heroes games for it.
Which are actually a spinoff of like Dragon Slayer.
Oh, I seen some YouTube videos about like Trails of Daybreak. And the first comment in the video was like, how dare you skip like 5 other games before this? You should go back and play them.
I hate everyone. That's it. Just like it. I just hate everything and everyone. That's it.
I can't stand these gatekeepers. This is why this fan base never grow.
I play whatever the fuck you want, man. Be free.
So I think Visions of Mana is technically Seiken Densetsu 5. Is that right?
I forget. Yeah. I guess. I mean, they made some games after 4. It was like Children of Mana.
Is it actually called Seiken Densetsu 5 in Japan?
I don't think so. No.
I don't know.
It's just called Seiken Densetsu Vision of Mana.
Okay. Because I'm pretty sure Dawn of Mana was called 4.
Yeah.
Okay. You gotta play Dawn of Mana before you play Visions of Mana. Sorry.
Speaking of trails, I'm just kidding, silly. The last three headlines here are all pretty small. 2 dates and 1 small little update. Trails of Daybreak, we talked about my impressions of that last week. This week, it got kind of a surprise update on PC. This is from P3, Durante's porting house, publishing house, we don't call it.
Sorry, I had to go check. It is called Seiken Densetsu Visions of Mana in Japan.
Oh, so
there's no known number. Sorry.
Oh, I said.
Yeah, bye-bye. Anyway, sorry, go on.
No worries. So this is something that I didn't know existed, but now Trails for Daybreak on PC on Steam is supporting the new Steam recording timeline feature, which is basically a feature that kind of tracks the way it's described. It reminds me of like the NVIDIA highlights thing that Shadowplay used to have, where it'll like track where you are, whether you're in a battle, a loading screen, whether you're opening a treasure chest, and basically that way you can easily like find video clips and share them, like automatically be clipped and highlighted. I've not done this myself on Steam. Like, I don't know if you have to opt into it or where the files are stored or anything like that, but now it does support that functionality. I remember this is when I read this, I don't know how similar this is, but it's what the description reminds me of. Out of all games, Elex 1 on PC supported the NVIDIA highlights thing where every time you leveled up, it like made like a 5-second clip. And I know like Sony PlayStation does this too, like whenever you get a trophy or whatever, it does.
It's so annoying if it does when it does it.
It's similar to that.
That's,
yeah.
It's like, imagine watching your favorite character die from Final Fantasy 7 and then you hear a trophy popped.
I think this feature is cool for Trails Through Daybreak and what Durante is doing. So it just basically makes it easier for people who want to share video clips of like cool moments in Daybreak to like just like, hey, yeah, everything is kind of color coded and a description of like what's happening. And it's like when you level up, or when you're in a battle, that's like highlighted in that timeline. When you're talking to a character, there's a character interaction going on. There's like a color coded way of like marking that on that video clip, you know. So it's just easier for people to kind of navigate what they recorded and share it with people.
I could have really used this like 2 weeks ago when I was still doing main story guide.
See, Durante, you know, was still working, but like it's always cool because Durante is such a pioneer in tech, I'd say. You know, he's always pushing the envelope of like how to make these releases be like the best they could be possibly be.
Okay,
he actually said that like applying this update to the game was, he said it was actually pretty simple, you know, relatively because of the API, I guess, that Steam allows. So Steam, however this is implemented, I'm not a tech person, developer person, but apparently the effort needed to actually implement this into the game was not too bad.
But it's also Durante too, so who knows what his standards are like. It's not too bad. It's like the most complicated process ever. But like to Durante, it's like, it's not too bad.
Look, I have the dumbest secret I'll share with you. I'm playing Daybreak 2, and the first thing I miss is the fucking water effects on the riverside for the Durante port.
Oh yeah, yeah.
My fishing doesn't feel the same without those realistic water.
in the Rante, dude. So yeah, just I just thought it was like a cool thing, like, you know, especially a specialist thing, like, you know, for RPG style. I was like, why not? So.
And the cool thing is that, like, it also, like, independent of the auto recording, like, you can do, like, the shadow. I still think of it as shadow play. I don't think NVIDIA even uses that name term anymore. But the background recording that it, like, only records a buffer of, like, 10 to 20 minutes, or maybe it's 5 minutes. I don't know what the limits are. But then dumps it unless you click to save it. So if you want to, if you have something that you're not expecting to be a highlight, you can record it. And then it also just has a manual recording mode. So if you don't want to mess with your GPU software or whatever, because it can be. I feel like I have an NVIDIA card, and it used to be like more, sometimes I have trouble getting it to engage. I'm like, record, please record. And then it doesn't, or whatever, or records the wrong screen. Maybe I'm doing it wrong, but the fact that it's integrated in Steam hopefully just makes it very, very turnkey. It can be done on Steam Deck, like, so you don't have to think about it. That way you can do it that way if you want. So just the functionality is nice. So Trails Through Daybreak is just like Josh said, just, hey, let's just implement this. It's not too hard. We'll try it out and we'll see how much use it gets. So to wrap this up, we just have two dates to help wrap up the month of July. This first one's actually already active at the time of recording. Inazuma 11 Victory Road, it had its beta event on Switch earlier, and now its worldwide beta is also active on PlayStation and PC as of July 18th. I think I saw, Josh, that you said that the PC port was struggling a little bit.
I don't know if they fixed it, but I feel like there's something fundamentally wrong with its PC release, but based on the Steam discussions, where a lot of people are getting like really low FPS on really competent hardware, and they had some weird fix, because there's like this odd behavior where if it's the active window, they'll get those FPS, that low FPS, but if it's like running as a background, like if they click out of the window, it runs perfectly fine. So people have had to like make some tweaks to like the back to make the background apps a priority for their hardware, and then it'll run okay. So I don't know if Level 5 has fixed that yet or not, but I'm just like, I will wait to see a better report or like a patch on it to try it out, because I do want to test it out on PC and try and play it there, but not in this state if that's the case.
So is the game officially out, or is it still in?
No, there's in a weird phase where it's still a worldwide beta test, where it released late March on Switch, and it's gonna wrap up there at the end of September on Switch. But they disabled new downloads on the Switch beta in late June. So if you haven't downloaded it before on Switch, you can no longer download it on the eShop because they brought it down on June. But if you already have it installed or you downloaded before on Switch, you can still play it till the end of September. Now, this deadline of September, I don't know if it applies to Steam and PlayStation's beta because of the way they forwarded it on their website, where it seems like that's only on Switch. So I don't know. But all the updates that came to the Switch beta is present in the PlayStation and Steam beta. So like story mode and all that stuff, like that was added eventually to the Switch beta, but it's all just all there present in PlayStation and Steam. It's a really, really weird demo release, and there's still no release date for the full game. Yeah, they just want to make this as good as possible before it like releases, pretty much. And they're like, Adam and I have talked about this on this podcast before, but Level 5 is really, really banking a lot on this Inazuma 11 Victory Road release. So they're being very cautious on the way they're releasing it, trying to just get as much feedback as possible before doing it.
Yeah, I know I kind of started the conversation out by saying, I heard the PC port's not very good, but it's also a beta. Like, suss that out for the beta and then get it, you know, squared away for the release. That's the goal. So
yeah.
Other people are being a little too harsh for it for not a actual release yet.
But I mean, it's good. It's better to have beta feedback now before its release rather than having to fix it up after, you know? I think this is ultimately a more healthy way to go about this if they're really really like going all in on this.
And at the end of the month, on July 31st, we have the latest update for Honkai Star Rail 2.4. And of course, I can read this press release, but it doesn't mean anything to me. Like, I can't compartmentalize it. Ciao, are you still up to date on Honkai Star Rail?
I'm always up to date. I clear every single content in it.
Okay, that's what I thought. I just didn't know, because you dropped Genshin while it was hot. So maybe news and the Zone Zero took you away from Honkai.
Ciao, you and I know that this update alone is not what people actually care about with the latest news release.
Yeah. This update, like the main game itself, there's not much of an update. It feels just like, oh, here's two new characters. Okay, yeah, cool. And then it's a sequel to the Ghost Story like event that kind of like happened like, I don't know, like five patches ago, and that's basically it, right?
But what's the real news that people care about with this latest update?
The real news that we actually know like absolutely nothing about. There is a collab that they announced right at the last minute of the video, and it's a Fate Unlimited Blade Works collab with Honkai Star Rail, and everyone's like, what?
Yeah, like, so coming quarter 3 2025, Honkai Star Rail is getting a collaboration event with the Fate Stay Night Unlimited Blade Works anime. So that's a very key distinction, because it's not a collab with Fate Grand Order or anything. It is with the anime of Fate Stay Night Unlimited Blade Works. So there's only a certain amount of like characters they can choose from. It's not like the whole Fate Grand Order roster or anything. It's still a very, very popular work, of course. And this kind of signposted before this. Like, obviously the collab news is very, very exciting, but miHoYo has been, or HoYoverse has been, this is not like unexpected, because there was a several months back, Kenoko Nasu visited HoYoverse to discuss like Honkai Star Rail and so forth. Like that, like HoYoverse like made a big deal about Nasu and I think the director or producer of Star Rail like having a conversation with one another. So like that obviously brought up the rumors, like, is there gonna be a collab event or anything come out of it? So for several months, like, people were like, I don't know, probably not. But here we are, like, of course, you know, after meeting with each other in real life over it, you know, obviously they reached the deal, hey, we'll have a collab event. So, you know,
it's still really far off. I don't know what it could be. That's the thing. It's like, okay, it's not exactly Fate, it's just like a route of Fate, and the anime of Fate. It's like, what does that mean? It's like, I am so confused, like what this could be, really, right?
So. Yeah, I mean, because UFO Table had that anime adaptation of Fate Stay Night Unlimited Blade Works. They never adapted
it. No, it was another studio that adapted. Do you remember the Fate Unlimited movies that nobody remembers?
Dean did the Fate route, so, like, way back when.
But there's a movie of Unlimited Blade Works.
Yeah, Dean did that. Yeah,
nobody remembers that.
Yeah, I mean that's pretty much been replaced by the UFO Table anime adaptation, pretty much. Right. And then UFO Table did a Heaven's Feel film trilogy as well. So I mean, like, they're only saying that because that's like the brand of it, like the property of, like, but like it's like when they're adding like a series in Super Robot Wars, they have to acknowledge that it's from the anime of it, just to have like the branding of it there. So when they say it's this for the anime adaptation of Fate Stay Night UBW, that means that like the pool of characters they can choose from, if they're going to add characters from it, are still open. It could still be, it's most definitely going to be at least one of them is going to be Saber, of course. That's
Gilgamesh,
like,
probably. That's
maybe Archer, you know. And that's the exciting part. It's like, how, when they add certain characters in it, how will their kit, like, move sets and kits be represented in Honkai Star Rail terms, like what element or attribute they're going to be given, and like what's the property of their moveset, which moves are they going to do, and like, of course, their big Noble Phantasm super attack, how's that going to look, and what's it going to affect in battle, you know?
You know what I want the collab characters to be like super broken. I hate when like a lot of like gacha games, they like team up with the collab character, and they're like the most useless piece of shit character that, you know, I don't even care they're there, you're never going to use them because they're
you remember Aloy and Genshin.
Yeah, I don't even know that she existed, like, 99% of the time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Or, you know who's the most useless collab character in Grand Blue? It's Sakura Kinomoto from Cardcaptor Sakura.
That's heartbreaking. What the fuck?
She's a SSR, but she cannot auto-attack, so she's basically useless.
Dang.
Right?
I didn't know they really did her to that like that in that game.
That's so I think people like raged about it. So like as years progressed, like newer collab characters became a lot more stronger, but they're still not like strong enough that they're like considered like the rollable SSR tier.
They're not meta to fighting. I think that's like really tricky to do because if you make a collab character as like a meta to fighting. Like,
which is an Epic 7. Epic 7 has meta-defining like collab Guilty characters. Gear. Like not the Guilty Gear one, the Slime.
They have Slime. I thought the Guilty Gear. Yeah,
they did a collab with the Slime anime. The Rimuru is like super OP when he first came out. So the tier list is called Rimuru and Friends. That's what the tier list is called, right?
That's awesome. Yeah.
But like, I want like super broken characters like that. But at the same time, people don't like that because they're like, oh... It's like these are like license exclusive. When they go away, you might never have the chance to get them again, right?
That's the fear, right? It's like if they're meta the fighting and they're never like powercraft by like anything that the game offers, then like the newer players in the game or returning players who were like active during that collab event will potentially never be able to acquire these characters because they're like because of all the license deal, like you know.
Yeah, it's a very hard thing to balance, Alan.
Yeah, think about like how many collab characters Grand Blue like never did a rerun of, you know?
As,
like,
I still want the Street Fighter collab to come back. It never did.
Yeah, but, you know, it's.
I think Cygames were like the sponsors for EVO at one point. I think they just stopped being the main sponsors these days. Probably.
I think they're still a sponsor, but they're not the main sponsor. I mean, like you see on the EVO streams, the series sees HoYoverse on there with Zenden Zone Zero. They're one of the sponsors. So you see, like, during the ad breaks, you know, you see a Zenden Zone Zero ad. And that makes you think, I know we're getting off topic, but that makes you think, you know, that's definitely one of the things they probably maybe discussed, like, when they were talking with, like, Capcom and the Street Fighter VI developers, you know, like, during that whole marketing, that really cool, like, 30-plus minute video talking about game design, you know. I wonder if they were able to like get in touch with like EVO through Capcom, you know, to maybe sponsor the event. You know, these are just like mindless theory. Like this is where my mind like drifts to of like thinking about the connections, like behind the scenes connections, and so forth. So I don't know, but yeah. So for this upcoming Fate collab with Honkai will not get me to play Honkai Star Rail. Done.
You already played it.
Yeah, I already played it. It's not for me. It's okay. I'll live with that. I'll be happy for the people like you, Chow, to keep me informed and let me know what's going on.
I'll let you know.
Yep.
That's just how it is.
That's how it is.
That covers us for upcoming dates in July. And actually, as you guys were talking about your tangent, I'm just kidding. I was looking at what's coming up like for the next week. And honestly, it's a little bit quiet for the rest of July. We have a couple Switch ports with Tokyo Xanadu EX Plus and One Piece Odyssey are coming to Switch on July 25th and 26th. We have the Werewolf the Apocalypse Purgatory game that we talked about last week. And then that's pretty much it for the next 7 days. At least listed on our RPG site calendar that Adam plugged just a minute ago. But as we wrap up, we do have the four reviews that we've mentioned up on the website at rpgsite.net. You can find RPG Site on pretty much all the social media channels. Just search for RPG Site and you should be able to find us. If you listen to this podcast, whether it's through Spotify or whatever podcast service of your choice, please leave us a rating or a comment. We do love to see and read those if we have time. And we'll be back, unless there's any other final comments, we'll be back next week with another episode of the Tetracast. Any other last parting wishes?
I can't wait to watch more EVO this weekend. That's my party comment.
I'm ready for
Punk. I do like here, I'll plug the Discord. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. There's actually quite a bit of EVO talk there. So I think the population overlap for RPG fans and fighting fans is even someone like me who doesn't really get into that, I do like seeing it just as like an outsider's perspective. It's fun to follow and watch. I forget who retweeted it, but someone was like in line for like signing up for their like bracket or whatever, and they had a guy holding a laptop while they were playing like Street Fighter, like two guys playing with corded controllers in line as they were going through the registration process.
That's awesome.
And I'm like, yeah, these guys are in it.
Yeah, it's pretty much always been described as fighting game E3, and that's an apt, you know, comparison. Mm-hmm. It's a celebration of fighting games for a weekend.
I think one of my favorite
of the world play.
I think one of my favorite tweets is like Fukuhara, who is like the the main director of Grand Blue. Yeah, he's like lining up for getting an autograph from Minaba Hideo, which is like their art director, because they worked at the same place. Like, why could you just get an autograph from him at work? It's like, that's not the place or time to do it.
Yeah, but it just really shows, you know, like Fukuhara is like, he's like such a very human character, and like just see him like seeing, like, you know, even though he's like ostensibly like, you know, his boss, you know, like he's still a fan of like of his work as well. Like,
oh no, my friends already tweeted. It's like, rip Daigo. Damn.
Oh wait, did Daigo get eliminated third strike?
Something else. I think they said again.
Or six. I don't know. We're gonna get on. We're gonna talk about Evil Forever if we go on. So yeah. Well, we'll come back next week with I don't know, something.
We'll play it by ear. Maybe we'll go deeper into Kunitsugami, or it'll be a surprise. Who knows?
We'll just talk about.
We'll be back next week. Yeah, maybe we'll just do that. All right, but if you made it to the end, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate all the support that you give us on our website and our podcast. We'll talk to you all next week. Stay safe. Take care. See you next time.
We love fighting games on RPG site.